Later this morning, Mark Steele joins Adrian Childs for Saturday Live and some cracking conversation with remarkable people. Today's highlights include Nuns in Space, Funeral Cosmetics and the Inheritance tracks of Matt Edmondson. That's at 9 o'clock. More immediately, after the news, Claire Balding heads to London's Broccoli and Ladywell. That's for this week's Ramblings. BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday the 14th of February. This is Lisa Costello. Good morning. The woman at the centre of the largest rape trial in French history, Gisèle Pelicot, has told the BBC she was crushed by the horror of her ordeal, but that she's a survivor. 51 men, including Madame Pelicot's husband of nearly 50 years, were convicted of rape, attempted rape and sexual assault at a trial in 2024. Dominique Pelicot had been drugging his wife with insomnia medication for almost a decade to sexually abuse her and allow others to do the same. Speaking to BBC Newsnight, Gisèle Pelicot said she was still seeking answers from her former husband.
I haven't had the opportunity to go and see him, and I hope to do so. That's also part of my way of rebuilding myself. I wasn't able to speak directly with Monsieur Pelicot during the whole trial. I always address the presiding judge, so I think I need to go and see him to get answers. I don't know if I'll get them, but face to face, I hope he'll be able to give me the answers I'm still seeking.
You can watch Gisèle Pelicot, the Newsnight interview, on BBC iPlayer now and tomorrow night at 10 o'clock on BBC Two. Sir Keir Starmer will say that both Reform UK and the Green Party pose a risk to Britain's safety in a speech at a security conference in Munich today. The Prime Minister will accuse his rivals on the left and right of being soft on Russia and weak on NATO. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
This is a major speech from the Prime Minister, setting out his foreign policy vision and calling on Europe to end overdependence on the US and cooperate more on rebuilding its defences. Sir Keir will use the international platform to attack the easy answers of what he calls the extreme left and the extreme right. The future they offer is one of division and then capitulation, he will say. The attack was dismissed by a Reform spokesman who said Sir Keir refuses to find the money to increase defence spending, and by a Green Party source who said he was a caretaker Prime Minister running scared.
President Trump has said the world's largest aircraft carrier will be deployed to the Middle East as the White House maintains pressure on Iran to make a deal over its nuclear program. The USS Gerald R. Ford will be the second American carrier sent to the region. Mr. Trump has said there will be traumatic consequences if Tehran fails to agree a deal. The chair of the Commons Public Accounts Committee has accused the outsourcing firm Capita of running a shambles in its handling of the civil service pension scheme. Sir Geoffrey Clifton Brown was speaking to Radio 4's Moneybox after two senior executives from the company were questioned by MPs on Thursday. The pension scheme currently has a backlog of 120,000 cases, a situation Sir Geoffrey said was dreadful. Dan Whitworth reports.
Capita took over the administration of the civil service pension scheme late last year, but thousands haven't received pension payments, leaving many in serious financial trouble. Capita's already apologised. It says it inherited more than half of the backlog of cases and has drafted in extra staff to try to urgently address the problems. But with commitments made to MPs to have sorted out priority cases by the end of this month and to have something like a normal service by April, Sir Geoffrey and his committee are expecting significant improvements by the time Capita executives reappear before MPs in around 7 weeks' time.
Team GB has won its first medal of the Winter Olympics, with Matt Weston taking gold in the men's skeleton. He set a track record in each of his four runs at the Cortina Sliding Centre in northern Italy, sealing victory in the final round last night. Matt Weston is the first British man to win gold at a Winter Olympics since Christopher Dean in 1984. Speaking to the BBC after his win, Weston said the victory meant everything.
I've worked so hard for this, but everyone back at home, like my fiance, my family, my friends, everyone that's sacrificed for me to be here, I've missed funerals, birthdays, everything to for this moment, and it feels amazing.
Now with the weather, here's Simon King.
Lisa, thank you so much indeed. Good morning. It's going to feel pretty amazing today as well, with some sunshine across most parts of the UK. First time in a very long time. But it is cold and frosty out there. So across England and Wales, coldest weather currently across parts of northern England and Wales. Temperatures widely below freezing. The risk of some ice, especially over the higher ground of northern England, where there's been some lying snow. But for most of us, though, it's going to be a bright, sunny morning. The cloud is going to increase, though, across parts of Wales and southwest England. Just high-level cloud making the sunshine hazy, and there'll be a bit of cloud building up across parts of East Anglia, but maximum temperatures getting up to about 4 to 7 degrees. For Northern Ireland, here after some sunshine this morning and a cold, frosty start, we'll see that cloud increasing, the high-level cloud. Some rain then arriving by this evening with a bit of hill snow, temperatures of 4 to 6 degrees. And across Scotland, yes, some showers across northern areas of Scotland. Frosty start, risk of some ice, snow over higher ground, but lots of blue skies and sunshine. Cloud increasing from the west, making the sunshine turn a bit hazy, and temperatures of 4 to 7 Celsius.
Thanks, Simon. Now for a look at the papers. And the Times reports that Thames Valley Police have held informal discussions with the government about emails and documents relating to Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor and Jeffrey Epstein. The paper says police are assessing whether there are grounds for an investigation into emails suggesting the former prince leaked confidential information to Epstein. Government sources have told the BBC they're not aware of any discussions, but it wouldn't be surprising if they had happened between civil servants and the police. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor has denied any wrongdoing. Thames Valley Police have been approached for comment. The Daily Mail leads on claims that when he was EU Trade Commissioner in 2004, Lord Mandelson travelled on a private jet belonging to a Russian oligarch to meet President Putin. They were attending an EU-Russia summit at The Hague. The Conservatives call the revelations disturbing and say they should be investigated. Lord Mandelson tells the paper he cannot remember travel arrangements from so long ago. The Daily Telegraph leads on an interview with the chief executive of the Electoral Commission. Vijay Rangarajan criticises ministers for allowing 30 local authorities to postpone elections due in May. Ministers have argued, the paper notes, that councils cannot afford to both hold elections and prepare for a reorganisation of local government. Mr Rangarajan tells the Telegraph that constraints in capacity are not a sufficient reason to take away from voters the chance to choose who represents them. And that's the news, weather and papers this morning. In half an hour here on Radio 4, Big Brother is watching Moo. Farming Today this week looks at AI developments in dairy, and it hears from farmers both north and south about the potential impact of the wettest January on record. What might it mean for this year's harvest and ultimately their business bottom lines? Now though, Claire Balding is in London for this week's Ramblings.
Meet me at the gates to the cemetery, she said. Sounds like the start of some sort of gothic macabre novel. But Hannah Such is meeting me at the gates to the cemetery. In the borough of Lewisham in southeast London, I've come in by train to Ladywell Station. Hannah, this is very much your home territory.
Yeah, this is my naturehood, as I like to call it. And today I'm going to take you on a wander around Greater Brockley.
And we're going to discuss the joy of finding your green spaces, even if you live in an urban environment, because, Hannah, you set up an app called Go Jauntly, which is a really simple way of people being able to connect to a local walk. Mm-hmm. It might only be 2 miles, 3 miles. Mm-hmm. Today we're going to do 4, I think.
Yeah, we're going to stretch this one out so that I get to spend as much time with you as possible. But yeah, the idea behind Go Jauntly was really to help urban city dwellers get out and about enjoying nature on their doorstep. Like very early on, I realised that London is actually 47% green space, and I wanted everyone to experience as much of it as possible.
If you want to follow us on the map, if you don't have the app, this is. We're on OS Explorer 162, which is Greenwich and Gravesend, and it includes Lewisham, Ladywell, Brockley, all of those. So grid reference TQ371 749, or on what three words we are junior foam crust.
Amazing.
Right, you're going to lead me then. So a circular walk, and are most of the walks that you plan on your app, are most of them easy to access and then get you back safely to where you started?
We have a wide variety of walks. I definitely personally prefer circular walks because they're really helpful if you're starting and ending at a train station, a bus stop, or perhaps you've like taken the car. But we do have linear walks. So as long as there's an onward place to go at the end of a linear walk, I find that's really helpful.
We're just going to cross this main road at a pedestrian crossing and head up into a park, a gentle rise ahead of us. There we go.
I think the good thing about parks and green spaces is that you can go along tarmac. And when we create our walks, we try and let people know like what terrain to expect. Because if you're going on a lunchtime walk and you're at work, you might not be able to get all of your shoes really muddy.
So you don't have to buy walking boots or walking trousers or poles. I'm sort of conditioned to still put my walking trousers on and my walking boots. But you could be going to a meeting, you could be going to the pub, you could be doing anything, and you've got a three-quarter length herringbone coat and you've got jeans on, and away we go.
Yeah, and I think in the past, like a lot of the sort of walking apps that were out there, they were really sort of targeted at you're already fit, confident hill hikers, and that's not the majority of people. And so I think it needs to be as accessible as possible.
We are gaining height rapidly. The wind is picking up behind us. There's a children's playground to the right, a swing ahead of me, a couple of benches. But just to pause and look behind towards the south, and that would be Kent. The sun is just breaking through the clouds. We've got houses around, but a lot of green grass. And I can just see over the brow of the hill ahead of us, so to the north, I can see the towers of the City of London.
Yeah, we're actually going to have two incredible views today as well. So this is the first one. And just over there, you can see to the south, you mentioned, that's Blythe Hill Fields, which we'll end up later.
Oh, great. It's all very well to sort of say, oh yeah, I set up an app as if it's something you can click your fingers and do, but it's a big business venture. You need some tech expertise. How did it all start?
So my background is in digital product design and development. I work with the likes of Google, Xbox and Nike agency side for much of my career. So tech is something that I felt really confident about.
The thought then of turning your expertise, I'm going to call it.
I love that.
I'm going to make up a word. You know, directing it towards walking. Where did that come from?
Oh, God. How long have we got?
We've got as long as it takes, Hannah.
So I think it's probably worth sort of sharing that I actually wasn't a lover of walking until like my mid-20s. And I came to it sort of very late on life. It just wasn't something we'd do as children. I met my husband, who's from the fields of Northumberland, and one day he took me back home to meet his parents and then took me for a walk. And I was like, what's this? Why are we going for a walk? And I remember saying to my father-in-law, the countryside is covered in poo, because they were surrounded by sheep farms and that's just what it was like. But I remember at the end of the walk, sitting by the fire and going, you know what? I feel pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And it's something that I wanted in my life. And then, you know, fast forward a couple of years, I had a son, we're growing up in a city, and I really wanted them to have a good relationship with the natural world. And so I realised there was a problem. I had a pram, had a kid, needed to change nappies, and wanted to go to the park, but actually didn't know where to go that would be accessible, pram-friendly, toilets, cafes, things like that en route. So what I found was that a lot of the platforms were like really hard to use, and this was something that actually I could problem solve, and here I am today.
Yeah. We've got tennis courts on our right hand side and people out in the winter weather playing tennis, and also those outdoor gym equipment being used. I'm always so thrilled when people are actually using stuff that's been put there by the council, and that view of the city and the blinking tower of Canary Wharf, the light on it that keeps flashing, is now much more evident. And it's a really lovely day. It's not as cold as you might expect. A whole group of mums with babies and prams outside the cafe on the left, and more dog walkers, little Pomeranian with its fluffy hair sticking out, coming towards us.
I think, you know, we really need to take up space, and it's really important to use parks and green spaces, cemeteries. They belong to us, and they also help connect you to sort of like the nature and heritage around you. Like, there's loads of amazing facts about Hillyfield, including Octavia Hill, one of the National Trust's original founders. She found out that there was a campaign to try and turn this into housing, but actually she fought to save it for us, and now we get to enjoy it every day.
I ought to mention we have a secret spy with us, and that's your husband, Liam, who's taking photos. Those will be available on the Instagram page, which is at BBC Rambling. So it was Liam who got you outdoors for a proper, what you would consider a real walk.
A proper walk. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, my mum tells me that I started walking at 9 months, but I don't think I really did. I actually started walking in my mid-20s. I'm not really a fan of the gym. I don't want to go to the gym, but I'm happy to go for a walk every day.
So congrats, Liam. Yay! He's silently celebrating.
Yeah, he also has to go through quite a lot, I think, as the partner of a, I hate this word, but entrepreneur. He has to sort of carry that burden of me being busy doing all sorts of things like this and then tagging along and taking photos.
Well, let's talk a bit about the business side of it, because I find this intriguing. And the leap from having the idea and going, right, I could help people like me, to actually making it happen and spreading it so that it's not just in London, is it?
No, it's not just in London. And to be honest with you, Claire, I completely underestimated the complexity and energy and like hard work and graft that would be required to create an app like this. Like, we're not funded by VCs or billionaire tech bros. It's literally us, a team of four, self-funded, bootstrapped, trying to help society through tech for good. And there were some meetings that I had sort of very early on, and I won't mention any names, but they were sort of big players in this field, and they pretty much told me I'd never be a success. I'd never be able to create an app that people would want to download, and how dare I step into the space. And I really feel like, you know, some of those conversations, I guess, put the fuel in the fire, shall we say. And it's not easy. The thing that's extra complex here is that not only am I trying to get people to download an app, which is really hard and really difficult, I'm actually trying to get them to sort of change behaviours of a lifetime. I'm trying to get people who don't walk to walk more. And so when you blend those things together, including trying to be sustainable, trying to make money, yeah, it was a big challenge.
And how do you balance the side of it that is for the good of society, so I assume making certain walks free to access, and the business side of it, which means you've got to have subscriptions, haven't you?
Yeah, so the app's free to download and it's free to access most of the features and most of the walks, and that's really, really important to us because we didn't want to create a new barrier to walking, but we also knew that we had to pay the bills and things like that. So we've got an optional premium subscription, and then you get to access some extra walks, some extra features. But most of our revenue comes from working with partners, people like Transport for London, Transport for Wales, and the National Trust, and 35 local authorities across the UK to bring free walks, free walking activities to everyone. We're just reaching a trig point here. So I think we're about 50 metres above sea level now. And we're also approaching London's only stone circle.
I did not know London had a stone circle. And okay, it's not Avebury or Stonehenge, but it is a perfect small circle of upright stones and a gateway of two tower stones.
It's very popular at the solstices, and actually every weekend you can pretty much see children's parties, exercise, all sorts going on around here. And there's also a sundial in the middle as well.
I'm assuming if you stood with this gateway either side of you, that must be west over there, and you see the sunset.
Yeah.
Through that gap in the trees. Great.
Yeah, so this is like this completely hidden little woodland that I think I lived here for like 5 years, and then one day I was like, what's beyond there? Let's have a look. And it was like this really pretty little nature reserve. Mm-hmm. And it's really tiny. Like, if you've got little ones, this is a really great place because it's all enclosed. You could let them run around wild. It's kind of not something that a lot of parents are sort of used to nowadays, really.
You said walking was not something you did as a child. Why do you think that was?
I'm from a sort of mixed heritage background, and when my sort of mum came to the UK, it was very much about trying to sort of build a better life for herself and things like that. And I think play and being outdoors, it just wasn't something that we did. And I definitely think that's why I don't like mud. It was like taught as like a nature nurture thing, yeah. But now, funnily enough, we've turned left here.
And go through this path, yeah?
Yeah, well...
Oh, I wouldn't have found this without the app or you.
I know. So this is really muddy, and I slipped over the other day trying to go up there when I was checking out the route. Are you going to go for it, Claire?
Yep.
Okay.
You've got good boots on.
You have.
Oh, I see. Here's the really slippy bit.
Yeah, I'm regretting this.
Oh, God. I think it's because it's clay. Ah, there we go.
So where did your mother grow up?
So my mum grew up in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. That's where she met my dad. And they moved back here. He was in the Navy, so he was away a lot. And I think it was probably really challenging, and she needed to build this life for herself. But it was quite a difficult childhood, I would say. And my parents' marriage didn't last very long.
Right.
And I moved around a lot. And all of those kind of things that happened when I was a kid resulted in the fact that I just was never really spent time in parks and green spaces or things like that. It just wasn't something we do culturally. We're going down this way, actually. So we're going to head off towards Ladywell now, which means kind of going past where we were earlier. What did you think of Hilly Fields?
Loved it. I thought it was great.
So we're going straight on here, and there's like this a little cut through that takes you through to Ladywell Fields.
How big is this space?
It's actually quite big. There's like split into three sections, but it follows the Ravensbourne River. Oh, sounds like leaf blowers.
That's what it is. I was thinking, what is that hum in the distance? It can't be strimmers. We've walked into a residential area. I wouldn't have known to go this way unless we were following the app. Well, unless I was following you, Hannah, to be honest.
So on the right is actually Ladywell Tower, and it kind of looks a little out of place in this little housing estate. So this area was actually, and I've got all of the facts on the walk, so you can
tell me about the water tower.
But so the tall brick structure you see is Ladywell Water Tower, and it was once part of a much bigger place where people lived and worked around 120 years ago. It was called the St. Olaf's Union Workhouse, and it was built on what was known as Slag Grave Farm.
So this was all a farm.
That's
and
right.
These brand new houses here, well, brand new, probably built in the 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have been here. This was all farmland.
Yes, exactly right. It was essentially like a hospital and a workhouse, and there were sort of separate living blocks, a laundry, a chapels, which is why there's a big water tower here. And they drew water from a deep well. And they were, all of the kind of other buildings were sort of demolished, and then this little sort of like housing estate was built. But it speaks to its Victorian past.
And the water tower itself, with its green door and its green hat, it's got the top section of it is all green.
Yeah.
It's clearly been turned into a house.
Yeah, they're flats.
Or
yeah.
Flats.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Imagine having to go up the stairs for that one.
Yeah.
So we're going straight on here, and there's like this a little cut through. Whew. We're just heading into Blythe Hill Fields now. And if you thought the Hilly Fields view was good, check this out.
Oh, I can see it starting to unfold, and a particularly good view of the Shard, which I always think looks like, you know those Arthurian jousting tents, that the peak was almost unfinished. I feel the top of the Shard is like that. And we can see the walkie-talkie and the gherkin.
Yeah, and the play button.
Which one's the play button?
I don't know what it is. But do you see there's like a triangle at the top? I can't remember the name of the building, but it looks a bit like a play button.
Oh, that's very clever. I didn't know that. The cheese grater?
The cheese grater, yeah.
And then round to the right, we can see Canary Wharf.
God, they just look kind of...
It looks like Gotham City.
It does, it really does, especially up here in the green, the budding trees.
Just pausing out of respect to a funeral cortege going past and the coffin being borne in a glass carriage drawn by two black Frisian horses with plumes on their heads and dad in flowers written alongside the coffin. Oh, look. You know, when you first showed me this map and it was like 176 steps, I was thinking, oh, that's a lot to get through. But we're making good progress.
Yeah, so the app is telling us to look out for a small community garden just here. And this is like a real hidden gem. And I actually discovered it during COVID because you couldn't walk very far. And I remember one day just being like, oh, I need to get out. I feel trapped. And then happened upon this really beautiful, locally maintained community garden. And I just thought it would be a really lovely place to kind of cut through onto the cemetery.
Lovely. So it's adorable. It's got logs on either side of a wood chip path going through various shrubs and plants, a little bench.
Yeah, and you've got amazing plants through the season as well. And there's all these little gnomes and like carvings. And there's even a little pond, and like in spring and stuff, you can see frogs spawn in there. So it's just a really lovely space. There's lots of little benches. You can sit down and just ponder.
We've crossed the main road one last time and back into the cemetery where we started. But at the furthest edge of it, the very chatty parakeet has just landed in the branch above us. But Liam, who's very much been the silent partner so far in this walk, can I ask you? What was your reaction when Hannah first pitched this idea, and what do you think now?
I love the idea of it. I didn't at that time ever think that it was going to grow into the huge mammoth amazing beast that it is now, so I was more than up for it, and being a designer I was more than happy to help visualize it all and come up with ways to make it all come.
You played an active role in contributing to and do you work for do you work together now?
Yes, I work for Hannah 2 days a week, full-time, doing all of the sort of design-based stuff, that everything that you see visually on the app. That's kind of my forte. And the other part of it, which I do when we are creating these walks, especially when we're creating them with partners, we have to go out and plot these walks. So whether that is doing the Capital Ring or working with Northumberland Council's, someone has to go out and plot these walks.
So do you put your hand out and go, oh, I'll do that?
100%. So what an amazing part of the job is to go off to somewhere and then just go on an adventure walking these routes that you've never been on before. You have to take photos and map it all, and it's, you know, it's not, so it's not like just doing a normal walk. There is work involved in it, but it's still, what an amazing thing to be able to do as a part of your job.
What do you do the other 3 days of the week?
I am a ceramicist. I studied ceramics a long time ago and then gave that up and became an interaction designer.
Oh, we just paused. There's a little robin come down onto the branch in front of us. They're so tame, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, we are 10 feet away and it's just sat there. Yeah, back to the ceramics, so go on.
Yeah, so Hannah bought me a membership at a studio about 10 years ago. I hadn't touched it for about 20 years, I think it was. So I went back into this studio and instantly fell back in love with it and started making homeware, and people started to like it, which was a big shock to me.
Oh, gosh.
And so I started selling it in shops, so I'm now selling a few different shops.
I think it's amazing that he's been able to go back to his sort of first love, and I think, you know, it's really important to be able to like work with nature as well for him. And I could really tell that that was missing from his life when he was sort of chained to his desk. And you are engaging and touching and manipulating clay, which is part of the natural world. I think it's all sort of like linked in a way. It's really nice that he gets to do the walking, which he's loved since he was a boy, and then playing with mud, which he's loved since he was a teenager. Yeah.
And also the fact that it is mud means that you can't really use your phone. That whole thing of disconnecting from your daily life and just focusing on this other thing, which is physical, it's hugely therapeutic.
Yeah, and also what I like about, you know, everything we've discussed, it's using your phone to make you look out rather than look at.
Yeah, it's very much a utility app. It's designed to encourage you to get out and about enjoying nature.
This way?
Yeah, this way, sorry. When we designed the app, we wanted to make it useful so you could use it with one hand, because I was always pushing a pram. So yes, that's why there's things like the kind of easy swipe left and right.
But will it also speak to you if you had a headphone, one headphone in, would it tell
you? We do have some walks that have audio, but we don't have that yet. But that's on the list.
Okay.
It's on the roadmap.
And as a business plan, have you got an exit strategy?
$1 million question.
Yes, I bet.
Or maybe a couple of pound question. What we know is that making an app is really hard work. It's really expensive. You're kind of beholden to the big trillion-dollar companies as well. So the likes of Google and Apple, who own that space, who own those app stores. So being able to get additional funding, being able to work with partners is definitely going to be a key part of whatever we decide to do next. And yeah, it's always on my mind.
If you've been listening to this thinking, I need to know more, go to the Radio 4 website and find the Ramblings page and you will find everything you need to know right there. But Hannah and Liam, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute joy to show you around my neighbourhood.
It's been a pleasure. What a lovely day for it as
I know, isn't it? This feels lucky. Like spring, doesn't it?
It does.
This isn't winter.
No.
I've even seen crocuses like peeking up, some snowdrops peeking up as we walk. It's happening. Spring is on its way.
A lovely thought. Ramblings with Claire Balding is produced by Karen Greger. It's a BBC Studios production for Radio 4.
What happens when someone's personality changes completely?
That's not Dad. There's something else that's gone on there.
I'm Noel Titheridge, and in a new series for Radio 4, I explore how medications prescribed to treat movement disorders like Parkinson's and restless leg syndrome have been linked to profound impulsive changes in behaviour. If these side effects can destroy relationships and even lead to criminality, why weren't some patients and families warned?
How much had I known him beforehand, and how much had I not known?
Impulsive starts on Monday afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 4, it's time for Farming Today This Week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. This week, rain, waterlogged fields and flooding misery for farmers.
I'm presently walking through a field of winter wheat here, and I'm just coming to a bit here that's kind of lying underwater.
There are hundreds and hundreds of acres of prime arable land underwater.
A flood is bad, whatever the flood, but this one's quite cruel in the way that it just creeps up. You can see it coming. There's nothing you can do about it.
And we'll hear from the boss of the Environment Agency on a large-scale natural flood protection project.
The key part about this one is to do with river restoration, improving flood resilience and river quality.
First, though, artificial intelligence, AI. It's starting to influence many aspects of our lives, and farming is no exception. This week, we looked at how the technology is being used in agriculture and how it might help in the future. Bristol Vet School's farm is trialling AI and CCTV cameras to spot changes in behaviour among its dairy cows, asking if it can pick up potential issues sooner than human herd managers and so improve animal welfare. Well, the project is publicly funded by UK Research and Innovation. Marie Lennon found out more from Windhurst Farm's manager, Ben Hunt.
On a day-to-day level, we've got 200 cows of milk yielding sort of 40, 42 litres a cow a day, so reasonably productive.
And we can just about hear the whirring in the background. You're on your second milking of the day, so three milkings a day. Professor Andrew Dowsey, tell me a bit about the work that happens here that you're involved with.
This platform now has 60 CCTV cameras that are
there. Well, you wouldn't even notice,
you wouldn't
would
even
you?
Notice it until you start looking.
Okay, there's one.
They're placed to cover the whole barn area, to monitor essentially the life course of each individual animal, and particularly to characterise their behaviours and social behaviours. From an artificial intelligence perspective, the last few years we've developed methods to identify each individual based on their coat pattern, but that allows us automatically to track each individual across our camera network. And from that, we've developed new techniques to recognise different behaviours that they're doing when they're interacting with each other, whether they're doing it in an affiliative, they're grooming each other, or whether it's a more agonistic interaction. The aim of the platform is to link that to various outcomes, productivity, welfare in particular, even potentially emissions going forward. So you can see whether one of the cows is very social one day, and then a few days later they've withdrawn a bit from the social network, and that might be indicative that they're coming down with some infection.
Ben, what do you think? Is it helpful from a kind of bottom line point of view?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, there are endless examples from forever of those really skilled herdsmen that can spot a sick cow a mile off. It's absolutely key to be able to pick up disease or infections really quickly, you know, in terms of effective treatment and trying to, yes, keep the cow productive but maximise her welfare and potentially use less antibiotics. And if we can see that from monitoring behaviour, huge implications that could have from a cost saving.
Into the office, away from the cows. What are we looking at on this screen here?
We are looking at essentially a big brother view of our cow shed. We can see if there are behavioural changes that predate actual clinical signs. Most technologies on the market are looking for clinical signs. But what we're looking for here are there subtle behavioural changes that predate those clinical signs so the farmer can potentially act sooner.
In reality, how likely is it that a dairy farmer just operating on a commercial basis could utilise this technology?
We are particularly hoping that this will transform into a product in a few years' time that could be used by dairy farmers. We've been running this data collection for a little under a year now, but obviously in a few years' time we'll have a full life cycle for a cow, and that opens up lots of interesting research in welfare research, in the biological research, but also into improved artificial intelligence too.
Professor Andrew Dowsey from the University of Bristol there. As I say, we spent the whole week talking about AI, so just search for Farming Today on BBC Sounds to hear more. Now, you really don't need me to tell you this. It has been wet. Very wet. And while we may have a respite this weekend, if you can honestly call a forecast which includes snow and ice a respite, more rain is forecast for next week. After what was the wettest January on record for some, more rain means more problems for farmers, from flooding and waterlogged fields to worries about the impact on this year's harvest and their bottom lines. Well, this week we heard from farmers at different ends of the country. Let's start in the usually relatively dry east of Scotland, which so far this year has experienced record-breaking rainfall. Here's Jack Stevenson on his farm near Banff at the start of the week.
I'm presently walking through a field of winter wheat here. The ground is very soft, and I'm just coming to a bit here that's kind of lying underwater. As you can hear, the ground's just like quicksand. Fingers crossed it does dry up, because we are on a drier farm, but there's certainly a lot of fields lying underwater in Aberdeenshire.
Well, Jack, who's chair of the National Farmers Union Scotland's Combinable Crops Committee, retreated to his warm, dry kitchen to talk to Anna Hill about those conditions on Aberdeenshire farms.
The rivers are at bursting point at the moment, and we've a lot of farmland next to rivers are flooded, and the ground can't cope with any more. It's just going to end up spilling over into lower-lying parts of the country. So it's wet, miserable, damp, dark and horrible.
How does that affect crops which are already in the field?
If they're underwater, like winter wheat or winter oilseed rape, 3 or 4 days underwater, more than that, and they will just rot out. And probably if it's a whole field, yes, that could mean a huge financial loss to the farmer. Whether he re-sows that field in the springtime, a lot of it will be parts of fields will have to be re-sown, or It just has a knock-on effect for the rest of the field, but it's crops came through the winter, they were looking very well, and we had quite a good November, December, but since the turn of the year with the snow in January and now this continual rain, it's beginning to certainly take its toll on the winter crops.
The crops that haven't rotted, could they get back on track? And the ones that you sow in the patches that need re-sowing, will they catch up?
Yeah, I mean, as long as the crop's not underwater, the winter crops, as the wheat and the winter barley, they were established very well and they were actually coming through the winter quite well. So they will get back on track. Yes, if we're having this conversation in the beginning of March, that's when we need to get on with early fertilisers, some herbicides and fungicides. That will have a huge effect on quality of the grain if we can't. But surely we're always optimistic. We'll look in the brighter side that it will dry up. But the areas of crop that a farmer maybe has to patch in, it's they're never going to be the same. It'll be too late for our winter wheat crop to be sown up here. Probably have to patch it in with maybe a cover crop or some spring barley. But they'll never be the same yield as the ones that's been sown in the winter time.
What are you doing, Jack? Are you sitting on the sofa watching the Winter Olympics? Or are you actually getting out there and doing things?
Well, Anna, we've a mixed farm, so cattle need to be fed twice a day. And there's lots of workshop jobs at this time of year that we can get on with. Machinery maintenance, and there's office work as well. Crop planning and doing the dreaded VAT. So there's most farmers, I would like to say, are still quite busy, especially if they've got livestock.
Farmer Jack Stevenson there near Banff. Well, in Somerset, tens of thousands of acres of low-lying moors and levels remain flooded. For weeks, communities have been coping with impassable roads and watching anxiously to see whether the frantic pumping operation is keeping the water at bay. Some homes have already been flooded. Well, on Thursday, I caught up with James Winslade, who farms near the village of Moreland. The vast majority of his land has been underwater for nearly 3 weeks now. He updated me on how close that water is getting to his buildings.
It's all around me. So I'm sat in the yard by a silage pit in my telehandler, and to the right of me, the other side of the buildings, there is water, and to the left of me, the same. So on a little strip of green down through a sea of water.
How close is the water to the village? Because you're near Moreland, aren't you?
Yeah, so we're cut off. There's a metre of water between myself and the village. They've put extra pumps in this week. They've dug around a bridge that was holding water back on the main drain heading towards Northmoor pumping station. So they've dug around that one. They're looking at digging around another bridge just to try and get water to the pumps. One house was flooded at the beginning of the week. Another one is about to flood. And then there's three or four other houses at immediate risk. So we're just hoping that the agency is nearly getting control again. But fortunately, it hasn't rained today. And we didn't have as much rain on Tuesday at the last yellow weather warning storm that came through.
And this has been going on for weeks now, hasn't it? Which must be a strain for everybody, farmers and everyone who lives there.
Everybody, yeah, yeah. It's not like a flash flood, fast-moving water coming in and you're sweeping your houses out the next day. Flood is bad, whatever the flood, but this one's quite cruel in the way that it just creeps up. You can see it coming. There's nothing you can do about it. And you're just sort of hoping that the agency get on top of it, because every drop of water here has to be manually pumped back into the river. So, you know, we're not like a normal floodplain would be, where it would come in at the top and then go out at the bottom. It takes months for it to go away. This water here now, 3 weeks on Sunday, it's been with me. It's going to take a month and a half to 2 months to get rid of.
What will this mean in the medium term for your ability to farm?
Oh, it's going to put a massive strain, as if farming wasn't a massive strain, under a massive strain already. It's going to put a massive strain. We're going to be short of grass. We're going to be short of crops. We're going to have to physically keep the animals in longer to wait for the grass to sort of either we re-drill grass or the older pastures to recover. Grass seed is £100 an acre now, so we'll have to do that, which we'd already put in all our herbal lays and our wildflower mixes for the environment, which that'll all have to be done again. So it's a huge cost.
James Winslade, who this week played host to the Minister for Water and Flooding, Emma Hardy. Yesterday, she talked to Justin Webb on the Today programme about that visit and said that the government's new flood funding formula should help.
It's so difficult for farmers. I was speaking to one on Tuesday. I went down to Somerset and he took me in the back of his trailer and the tractor around to show how, well, I mean, I wouldn't even say waterlogged. It was like a lake, the fields around his farm. And he was explaining to me the real difficulty he had because he grazed cattle. So they were, at the moment, they're obviously inside. But the problem is by the time the water goes, the grass hasn't had time to grow. So he's got to replant the grass. And he was explaining all of this situation to me.
And no insurance and as well for crop damage. That's the other thing they said.
Yeah, it is very difficult. So I've been having conversations with the farming ministers to see what we can do. I mean, when it comes to the new flood funding formula that comes in from April, which is one that we've designed under this government, it does look in the formula about the impact on farmland, whereas previously it was more the number of properties impacted determined where you would spend money for flood defences. So for the first time, farmland will be taken into account, but obviously that's the way the formula is designed from April. So I think, you know, I do recognise it's really difficult. And I heard that, as I say, very passionately from the farmer I was talking to on Tuesday. And it's something I'm trying to have conversations with about what can be done because, you know, climate change is real. And we are going to continue to see these patterns of increased wet winters and very, very dry summers. And they've just gone through a drought in summer and now they're facing flooding in winter.
The Minister for Water and Flooding, Emma Hardy. The Country Land and Business Association, the CLA, says the financial pressure caused by winter flooding following on from that summer drought at a time when arable and milk prices are also poor is taking its toll. Some farms, they say, are having to change what they're doing to cope. Joe Evans, the Deputy President of the CLA, farms organic livestock on the Herefordshire-Worcestershire border. He spoke to Anna.
Right now, the farm is a complete quagmire. Though I would count myself as one of the luckier ones in that we don't rely on arable farming on our farm system here. Driving my son to school this morning around the Worcester bypass, and there are hundreds and hundreds of acres of prime arable land underwater. So it's really grim.
We've had unpredictable weather for some time, haven't we? Have you taken steps to become more resilient to the extremes of wet and dry?
Well, it's funny you should say that. I think I've had a conversation with my contract farming partner every year for the last 5 years about what an extraordinary, strange year it's been for weather. So one has to get to a point where you realise this isn't extreme. This is now business as usual as a result of climate change. Well, the answer is yes, in that we are absolutely adopting an extensive farming system and trying to make sure that, you know, we have lower stocking densities to give the ground more time to rest. I think for CLA members that are having to deal with this, whether or not it's adapting or surviving, I mean, they're two slightly different ways of looking at the situation. But I know of farmers, certainly in Somerset, that have given up on arable enterprises altogether, such as the frequency of their farms flooding. The industry is having to face it. This is going to be business as usual, I'm sure, for the foreseeable.
Some people might just shake their fist at the sky and say, oh, this is terrible, curse those clouds. But actually, isn't it for farmers then to take action themselves and say, right, I'm going to change what I'm doing on the farm?
I think there's a bit of that. And I think, yes, it's a fair challenge, Anna. I mean, but the action so often requires an underlying policy and regulatory support from government to actually enable them to do it. So one example would be being able to hold water on farm reservoirs. And we've been pushing very hard to get permitted development rights to be able to enable farmers to build on farm reservoirs, which does great things at points of excess like now. And then, of course, holds that water back for us to use at times of scarcity in the summer. But we need a planning system that will enable that to happen. And then I think farmers would crack on. And I also think that it's really important the government properly funds environmental land management schemes to ensure that farmers have the right policy conditions that they can adapt their farming processes to improve the quality of the soils, the draining of those soils, making sure there are winter cover crops so the soil doesn't all get washed away, etc., etc. It's a whole combination of these measures.
Yeah, that's interesting because those things depend on funding for agri-environment schemes, don't they? And that funding is pretty scarce at the moment.
It seems so, yeah. I mean, it's political choice, isn't it? And I understand that this government has lots of challenging political choices to make. I just feel that the quantum of the agricultural budget in the scheme of wider government spending is very, very small. And the impact can be really huge, not only for farmers, and you could say, well, lucky farmer, but actually the impact on the widest, on wider society and being able to take steps to be able to hold water back to avoid communities being flooded feels to me like a really good thing that the government should put its resources into.
Joe Evans, the Deputy President of the CLA. Well, the government in England might point to projects it is funding as part of ELMS environmental land management schemes, which replaced the old EU subsidy system and, as we've reported, have been beset with problems. They pay farmers only for the public goods they provide, things like planting trees and rewiggling rivers, both of which can slow the flow of water. Well, this week, a landscape recovery project in Oxfordshire got the official go-ahead. It's part of the government's £500 million fund for long-term, large-scale land management schemes in England, which use a mix of public and private money to provide environmental benefits. The Evenload project in the Cotswolds is being delivered by a cluster group of more than 50 farmers and will work to reconnect floodplains and restore rivers. Marie Lennon was at the launch.
Under a grey duvet sky and relentless winter rain, a group of farmers and members of DEFRA and the Environment Agency have gathered together at, and in some ways because of, this river, the River Evenload, that runs through many farms here in the Cotswolds.
And just like the lapwing that we've seen flying over, and a few snipe that have got up, and there's a few swans in the background as well, they're only here because it's wet, right? They're all wading birds. So what we're going to try and do is create that wetness for longer in the season, whilst also creating that landscape sponge that reduces that flood stress downstream.
That's Tim Fields, one of over 50 farmers that are part of this project.
This idea came from a group of farmers that all wanted to connect their habitats up together. The man standing next to me, Tim Coates, suggested we went into landscape recovery, as did a few of the other members of the cluster. The farms that we're working with, we really targeted what's called the flow pathways, which is where the water hits the ground in a big storm event and flows over the top and enters the ditches, the rivers, very quickly, carrying lots of sediment with it. And what we've tried to do is target those areas, hold that water back, changing land use where it's particularly steep, perhaps rewooding some of the slopes, and creating wetlands and so on in strategic places to slow that flow. And then once it's in the river, to reduce that flooding, we increasing the sinuosity, we're making it wiggly.
It's building resilience in that farm asset, but it's also paying and therefore creating economic resilience. You know, we've got this 20-year contract underwritten by the government and crowding in the private finance as well. Farmers are getting paid for the actual value of the ecosystem service they're providing. I think all the farmers have seen ourselves as farmers. We want to produce, you know, healthy food for the population, but we've always been land stewards. But it's also about recognising that we're actually, therefore, we get to make the right choice for the land that we know.
Alan Lovell, chair of the Environment Agency. We are out in one field as part of this 3,000-hectare project. First of all, why do you think this is a valuable project?
The key part about this one is to do with river restoration, improving flood resilience and river quality. But more importantly, it's the landscape recovery projects are on a scale which can really make a difference, which is so great for biodiversity and real nature extension into areas that have been lost.
Is that the best use of public money right now?
Yes, it's a very important use of public money if one respects nature and respects all that nature gives us in so many ways. I mean, our calculation is that the economic benefit is actually 8 times what it is going to cost.
How's that worked out?
In terms of the government, some of it is environmental benefit, some of it is farming benefit, and some of it is community benefit. The idea is that the government money should be matched by money from private sources, and they will all be looking to make a return on it. So the fact that there is opportunity for private investors gives some support for the idea that the government money will also be very a wise investment from which we all will benefit.
And with that in mind, why is it the case that there is a clause in the contract for an opt-out of that funding from DEFRA with a 12-month notice period? I mean, some would say that that shows it's not about long-term thinking, and it makes it quite risky for farmers to commit for such a long period over such a huge scale.
It is a very long period. I think that at this early stage of the scheme, though, it is reasonable for the government to set some hurdles along the path and to give the farmers the challenge to make sure that they are keeping up with that. I think it's reasonable not to commit it all absolutely up front, but to say, here's what we're going to give you, but you've got to play your part in that, and then we'll be backing.
Is there a worry, though, that it might make investors feel a little bit edgy?
The early indications are that that's not the case. The proof of the pudding will be in the eating, but I don't think so.
There are many farmers, as you will know, up and down the country, who regularly have their fields, which could be productive fields, under feet of water, and they say that they're really forced to allowing their fields to flood to protect infrastructure downstream, or to protect dwellings or villages or whole towns. And they have been crying out to the Environment Agency and to DEFRA to say, we will do this public good, but we should be paid for it. That is what's happening here, but should this approach be taken further around the country to individual farms?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that a lot of farmland is at risk from flooding. We recognise that. We're delighted that DEFRA's latest funding scheme for flood defence will give more credit to all value for money projects, as opposed to just the property focus which they have had to date. We do think it's very important that there is more support for farmland that is at risk from flooding. In many cases, the farmers were paid a sum for recognising that their farms would be part of the floodplain. And of course, in many areas, including Somerset and including the Fens, that is their natural state, and there's no way of getting around that. So we will do our best, but it's within the confines and subject to the vagaries of nature, which undoubtedly is getting more challenging in many respects. I completely agree.
Alan Lovell, Chair of the Environment Agency. Do let us know what you think about flooding and indeed drought, and what we can do to mitigate. You can email us. We're farming.today@bbc.co.uk. But that's all we have time for. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Beatrice Fenton. And Farming Today this week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
You're listening to Radio 4 today, bringing a glimmer of hope on the weather front. Here, Simon King with the good news.
I am indeed, Lisa. Yes, good morning. A day of sunshine across many parts of the UK today. I haven't said that in a very long time, but it is cold and frosty out there this morning. There is the risk of some ice in parts as well. But let's start off in southwest England and across Wales. Temperatures generally at or below freezing this morning. We might see a bit of cloud develop with the odd wintry shower to the north west of Wales today, but for most of us, it's a dry and sunny day. Later on this afternoon, we will start to see some higher cloud moving in from the west. That will just make the sunshine turn a bit hazy, but maximum temperatures getting up to about 5 to 7 degrees. Now, for southeast, eastern England and across the Midlands, temperatures about freezing here this morning, so a pretty cold start, especially with a rather brisk northeasterly wind. The wind will ease off, though, and we are going to see a little bit of cloud towards East Anglia today, but otherwise, though, dry with lots of sunshine, and we'll see maximum temperatures getting up to about 5 to 7 degrees. Across northwest and northeast England, it's a cold start, a widespread frost, and the risk of some ice, especially over the higher ground where there's some lying snow. We are going to see lots of sunshine, though, especially in the northeast. In the northwest, there will be a bit of higher cloud moving in, making the sunshine turn a bit milky, highs of 4 to 7 degrees. Northern Ireland, cold and frosty and potentially icy for some. Lots of sunshine this morning, but by lunchtime in the early afternoon, again, some higher cloud moving in, making the sunshine turn hazy. And then by this evening, we will see some rain and then hill snow pushing in, with a strengthening southwesterly wind, highs of 4 to 6 degrees. And for Scotland today, frosty and icy this morning. Temperatures generally down to -3 to -8 Celsius. A few showers across the far north of Scotland. Otherwise, lots of sunshine. Again, that sunshine turning a bit hazy in the west. Highs of 3 to 6 degrees. But through tonight, rain is going to spread in from the west with a strengthening southwesterly wind. As that rain hits cold air, we're going to see some snow, even temporarily down to low levels. But it's going to be preceded by some milder air. So snow at low levels turning increasingly to rain. Snow, though, will be falling and settling over higher ground for a time, the risk of some ice into Sunday as well.
Thanks, Simon. The Today programme is next, but before that, what will the pharma revolution in weight loss mean for us all?
I'm no longer ravenous. I'm no longer desperate. I'll no longer eat until I fall asleep and I have to rest.
The Hunger Game, a new 5-part series exploring the meteoric rise of weight loss drugs.
It's been an incredible story with these drugs. The uptake, the amount of product that's been sold, the amount of money it's cost, the amount of money that's been made.
What the drugs do, how they work, and the knock-on effects of their widespread use.
People are having to completely alter the way they do business.
The Hunger Game with me, Professor Giles Yeo, from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
On FM, on digital radio, and on BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 4.
It's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 14th of February. Good morning. This is Today with Darshini David and Justin Webb.
Your headlines this morning. Gisèle Pelico, who was drugged and raped by her husband for more than a decade, tells the BBC why she decided to waive her right to anonymity and why shame must be carried by the accused, not the victim.
When I decided against a closed hearing, I wanted the shame to shift to the other side. I'd carried that shame for more than 4 years. That self-inflicted pain, I felt, meant victims were being punished twice. And I thought that if I was able to overcome it, all victims could do it too.
And Sir Keir Starmer will use a speech in Munich to accuse Reform UK and the Green Party of posing a risk to British security.
And also in today's programme, the Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, on the state of Europe's relationship with the US.
The US is completely committed to Europe, more than ever, I would argue, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, because they see the Europeans stepping up.
The President of Finland will join us live at 7:30, and it's gold for Team GB.
We knew in Skeleton that Matt was going to race well. The team texted yesterday to say that they were ready. He just delivered the gold medal race when it counted.
As Britain's Matt Weston secures gold, we'll hear reaction from former Olympic champ Lizzie Yarnold.
Hello from me, Mike Williams, with the rest of the sport live in Edinburgh this morning on Calcutta Cup Day. Scotland host England later in the Six Nations at Murrayfield, looking for a reaction to their opening round defeat last weekend. I've been speaking to the Scotland captain.
The BBC News is read this morning by Lisa Costello.
The woman at the centre of the largest rape trial in French history, Gisèle Pelico, has told the BBC she was crushed by the horror of her ordeal, but that she's a survivor. 51 men, including Madame Pelico's husband, were convicted of rape, attempted rape and sexual assault at a trial in Avignon in 2024. Gisèle Pelico has been speaking ahead of the publication of her memoir to BBC Newsnight's Victoria Derbyshire. Her report contains distressing details.
From 2011, for almost a decade, Gisèle Pelico was repeatedly drugged and raped by her then-husband, Dominique Pelico. He also brought dozens and dozens of other men he'd met on the internet into their home in order to rape her too, filming the abuse and storing the footage on his laptop. Madame Pelico said being told what her husband had subjected her to had a devastating effect.
I told myself that it was inconceivable that this man who shared my life could have committed these horrors. It was a descent into hell. Our family was totally destroyed. We were crushed by the horror.
However, Gisèle Pelico also said she is a survivor, that strength is in her DNA, and she urged rape survivors everywhere never to feel ashamed.
You can watch Gisèle Pelico, the Newsnight interview on BBC iPlayer now and tomorrow night at 10 o'clock on BBC Two. Sir Keir Starmer will say that both Reform UK and the Green Party pose a risk to Britain's safety in a speech at a security conference in Munich today. The Prime Minister will accuse his rivals on the left and right of being soft on Russia and weak on NATO. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
This is a major speech from the Prime Minister, setting out his foreign policy vision and calling on Europe to end overdependence on the US and cooperate more on rebuilding its defences. But his mind seems drawn to the political battles at home. Sir Keir will use the international platform to attack the easy answers of what he calls the extreme left and the extreme right. The future they offer is one of division and then capitulation, he will say, and warn that under their watch, the lamps would go out across Europe once again. The attack was dismissed by a Reform spokesman who said Sir Keir refuses to find the money to increase defence spending, and by a Green Party source who said he was a caretaker Prime Minister running scared.
The conference in Munich is taking place against the backdrop of worsening ties between the US and Europe. The American Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, is due to address the gathering after telling journalists yesterday the world was in a new era of geopolitics. From Munich, our Europe editor, Katia Adler, reports.
The Munich Security Conference is seen as a sort of annual litmus test of transatlantic relations. Over the past year, the Trump administration has slapped tariffs on Europeans, tried to bolster politicians in Germany, Hungary and Poland, for example, that Washington believes are in tune with what it views as Trump values, and threatened the sovereignty of NATO ally Denmark over Greenland. So, the conference speech this morning in Munich by the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who represents the White House here, is awaited with bated breath. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte told me he was confident the US was more committed than ever to the continent now Europeans were upping their defence spending. But the US has also been clear Europe is no longer a top priority.
President Trump has said the world's largest aircraft carrier will be deployed to the Middle East as the White House maintains pressure on Iran to make a deal over its nuclear program. He said the USS Gerald R. Ford would travel to the region very soon and warned of traumatic consequences if Tehran failed to reach a deal. Our North America correspondent Simi Jalawasho reports.
President Trump spoke to journalists after attending a military event in North Carolina. Asked whether he wanted regime change in Iran, he said it seemed like the best thing that could happen. He declined to say who could replace Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. He noted there are people who could take over. Iran is yet to respond to Mr. Trump's latest remarks. This comes as the world's largest warship heads from the US to the Middle East, making it the second American carrier in the region. Despite the military surge, talks are set to continue, with US envoys expected to meet Iranian officials on Tuesday.
The Prime Minister of Canada, Mark Carney, has, along with the heads of all Canadian political parties, attended a vigil in the town of Tumbler Ridge, where eight people were shot dead by a teenager on Tuesday. Five of the victims were pupils aged 12 and 13 at the attacker's former school. 18-year-old Jesse Van Rootselaar, who died at the scene, had a history of mental health issues. Mark Carney told the vigil that Canadians were mourning with them.
I know that nothing I can say will bring your children home. I know that no words from me or anyone can fill the silence in your homes tonight, and I won't pretend otherwise. But standing here together, we wanted you to hear the Canadians are with you.
A man who was shot by police in Paris after attacking an officer has died. The incident happened yesterday evening during a ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier under the Arc de Triomphe. Prosecutors say the man had been released from prison in December after serving a 12-year term for terrorism offences. The chair of the Commons Public Accounts Committee has accused the outsourcing firm Capita of running a shambles in its handling of the civil service pension scheme. Sir Geoffrey Clinton-Brown was speaking to Radio 4's Moneybox after two senior executives from the company were questioned by MPs on Thursday. The pension scheme currently has a backlog of 120,000 cases, a situation Sir Geoffrey said was dreadful. Dan Whitworth reports.
Capita took over the administration of the civil service pension scheme late last year, but thousands haven't received pension payments, leaving many in serious financial trouble. Capita's already apologised. It says it inherited more than half of the backlog of cases and has drafted in extra staff to try to urgently address the problems. But with commitments made to MPs to have sorted out priority cases by the end of this month and to have something like a normal service by April, Sir Geoffrey and his committee are expecting significant improvements by the time Capita executives reappear before MPs in around 7 weeks' time.
Team GB has won its first medal of the Winter Olympics, with Matt Weston taking gold in the men's skeleton. It's the first gold medal for a British man at the Winter Games in more than 40 years. Weston smashed several records on his way to victory at the Cortina Sliding Centre in northern Italy. Joe Curry reports from Livigno.
Matt Weston was always going to be the man to beat, but if he felt under pressure, it didn't show. He cemented his status as the best skeleton racer in the world as he made history by winning gold in emphatic fashion in Cortina. Weston, who was already world champion, set a new track record on all four of his runs. The 28-year-old is Britain's first ever male skeleton champion and now also becomes the first British man to win winter gold since the figure skater Christopher Dean in 1984. Later today, Team GB's female skeleton racers will have their go at the podium. Tabby Stoker was fifth fastest after the first two runs. Meanwhile, in Milan, there was a shock result at the figure skating as the American star Ilian Melilin, who had previously wowed the crowds with his backflip, fell twice during his routine and ended up finishing eighth in the individual event.
Joe Curry reporting.
Lisa, thank you. It's exactly 7:10, so time to rifle through the weekend papers. The Times are still looking at the fallout from the revelations in the Epstein papers. Reports that the Thames Valley Police have held informal discussions with the government about emails and documents relating to Andrew Mountbatten, Windsor and Epstein. The paper says that police are assessing whether there were grounds for an investigation into emails suggesting that the former prince leaked confidential information to Epstein. Now, government sources have told the BBC they're not aware of any discussions, but it wouldn't be surprising if they had happened between civil servants and the police. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, of course, has denied any wrongdoing, and Thames Valley Police have been approached for comment.
Palestine Action is on the front pages of quite a few of the papers. The Guardian leads with Palestine Action ban ruled unlawful in blow to ministers. Judges have humiliated ministers, the Guardian says, by insisting that Palestine Action should not be banned under anti-terrorism laws in a ruling which has left thousands of its alleged supporters in legal limbo. Meanwhile, the Mail talks about the threat to Jewish people in Britain at the moment. Sir Stephen Watson, the Chief Constable of Greater Manchester Police, talking after the jailing of those two Islamic State supporters who had tried to get themselves into a position where they could attack Jews. The senior officer, this is Sir Stephen, saying that Jewish communities in Britain had to put up with a way of life that nobody else has to put up with. They have more justification to be fearful than anyone else, Sir Stephen added. We've seen terrorist atrocity in Manchester at a synagogue. We've seen events in Bondi Beach, etc. If our Jewish communities are under threat, he also added, we are all under threat.
And we'll be talking more about the High Court ruling at 7:50, so later on this hour. But a quick nod to 14th of February, of course, The Guardian, featuring a story about what else? Red roses on Valentine's Day, but bah humbug, it says it's the flower with the highest concentration of pesticides. It says that lab testing and bouquets in the Netherlands found one bunch had 26 different types of chemicals, half of them banned. So there's an excuse not to buy any.
12 minutes past seven is the time. The question hanging over the Munich Security Conference is Europe's ability to defend itself in a new world in which the US is taking a very different view of its own position. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, saying the world is changing very fast right in front of us. And he's due to be talking more in an hour or two's time. Let's talk to Ezra Cohen, though, who was Under Secretary of State for Defence Intelligence in the first Trump administration and is on the line from Munich now. Good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. How would you characterise the state of the relationship between the Trump administration and Europe writ large at the moment?
Well, I think that, you know, putting aside all of the public political comments that have been made, I think relations are actually quite well. Thanks to President Trump and the administration, NATO defense spending is up. The Europeans are doing much more. You know, at the end of the day, look, there's going to be a lot of tension in public over things like trade. But when it comes to the defense relationships, I think that they're stronger than ever.
Do you think Greenland now as an issue has been put to bed, or is it still there? Is the Trump administration's desire to go further in its efforts to take over Greenland still there? Or do you think they feel now rebuffed and they're just going to leave it?
Well, first of all, President Trump is not just going to leave the situation in Greenland, you know, as it was a couple of weeks ago. There still is a strong need to provide security inside of Greenland, but also around Greenland from Russian, Chinese incursions. It is a critical place for the United States. And I think that, and what I'm seeing here in Munich is an actual acknowledgement from Europeans that the security situation in and around Greenland is a legitimate concern.
That's interesting. So you're seeing from the European side that acknowledgement, but does that then mean from the American side that the actual naked threat to take over territory in a European nation or a nation ruled by a European nation, that threat is off the table?
Well, everybody in the Trump administration, they were quite clear that there was never going to be an armed invasion of Greenland. There was a diplomatic negotiation. It appears to me that they're still working through all of the details. But I think the key thing is there is an acknowledgement that President Trump is correct, that we do need to do much more to secure Greenland and also the Arctic writ large.
And just looking at what's going on in Ukraine at the moment, and President Zelensky obviously is going to be in Munich and talking to people. I think he is talking to Marco Rubio in the sidelines of the conference. How would you characterize that? What is the current state of the Trump administration's view of Zelensky and of the immediate future in Ukraine?
Well, I think we're going to get a better idea here in an hour when the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, speaks. But right now, the administration is obviously continuing to put pressure on both sides to come to an agreement. Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff are working very, very hard at this. I do think there's a sense that we are closer to some sort of agreement. The situation really remains the same as President Trump laid it out when he first came into office, which is the U.S. It's not even that we don't want to. The U.S. is not able to continue to provide an endless supply of materiel and aid to Ukraine. There has to be some end to this. And the only way to get there is by ending the conflict.
Ezra Cohen, Undersecretary of Defense Intelligence in the first Trump term, joining us from Munich. Thank you very much.
It is now 16 minutes past seven. Are you fed up of the relentless rain? You're not alone, but if you manage to drag yourself out of bed, you might just get a glimpse of the sun today. However, plunging temperatures too, also warnings of snow and ice. Well, Dr. Liz Bentley is the Chief Executive at the Royal Meteorological Society. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
It is, of course, winter, but it has been a pretty extraordinary one. What is going on, not just here, but across Europe too?
Yeah, so if we focus on the eastern side of Europe, the UK, as you say, we've had a particularly wet spell. Some places saw their wettest January on record, and that's continued as we've gone into February. So heavy rain, persistent rain. So across the UK, some places have seen rain on every day since the beginning of the year, 43, 44 days of rainfall. Some places haven't seen sunshine for 3 weeks until the very recent days, as we've seen this cold weather starting to push in. Down in the southwest of Europe, in Portugal and Spain, the rain has been even heavier there. They've had persistent storms coming through. That's led to fatalities, but also about 100,000 people being evacuated from houses there. And then in contrast to all of this, if you go over to Eastern Europe, it's been exceptionally cold. High pressure has dominated, and that's led to temperatures plummeting away. Minus 34 in Lithuania, minus 20 in Ukraine, and parts of Sweden have seen their second coldest January on record. So some real contrasts across Europe.
Some real contrasts. Then begs the question, why? And is there an end to this in sight?
Yeah, so high pressures dominated across Eastern Europe, and that's led to the cold conditions I've just mentioned. But that's also blocked these weather systems that have been coming in off the Atlantic towards the UK, towards Portugal and Spain. And they've then just sat across eastern parts of Europe, delivering all that rain day after day after day and the cloud that I talked about. So that's the reason everything's been a little bit stuck until recently. And at the last couple of days, that cold weather has moved a little bit further east, so it's colder out there. It's also a lot brighter. Brighter today. So for us, some sunshine today. We see the end of the rain, but it's only a short-lived break before we get back
to the
rain.
And a quick mention for the Southern Hemisphere too, because things have been unusual there.
Yeah, or clearly in the Southern Hemisphere, it's their summer, but it has been exceptionally hot. So we're seeing a number of heatwave events happening in different parts of the Southern Hemisphere, in Australia, for example. So, yeah, the cold conditions across Eastern Europe, moving across the UK, but very hot conditions across the Southern Hemisphere.
Professor Liz Bentley, thank you.
It is 19 minutes past seven. Donald Trump has announced he's sending a second aircraft carrier group to the Middle East. He warns it'll be a bad day for Iran if it fails to make a deal on its nuclear program. The US's military build-up coming, of course, amidst intensified diplomacy. Iranian and American negotiators meeting in indirect talks earlier in the month in the Gulf state of Oman, described by both sides as positive, although little progress reported in actually resolving the main issues. In Iran itself, meanwhile, people struggling with inflation, soaring at around 60%, the currency in a free fall against the dollar. It is an economic crisis rooted in decades of crippling international sanctions, but as well in mismanagement and corruption at home. And it was those financial woes which sparked the recent protests, which spiralled into major unrest. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, has been given rare access to visit Iran. Reports now on the mood in a Tehran market.
We're just pushing through the crowds here, coming to any of the markets in Tehran. But this one is such a feast. It's beautiful to behold, but it's painful too, because it's a measure of rising prices and the rising pain in people's lives. And this is here from some of the shoppers.
Prices are so high.
Are you hopeful that there'll be a deal between President Trump and Iran?
I think we will reach the agreement.
There will be?
Yeah, I think so. Because it would be, the future is really dangerous. Nobody knows if the United States is going to attack Iran. It will have very terrible consequences.
What do you think could happen here?
No one knows.
Were you in Tehran during last year's war?
Yes.
And what was it like?
Terrible, unfortunately.
It was scary.
Yeah, it's really scary.
So that would help, do you think, help your life if there was at least a deal, a nuclear deal?
For sure, if you have a deal, probably they decrease the sanction. Mm-hmm. And I think the condition become better.
So just explain to me, how does the sanctions affect your life? Like, what can't you do?
For sure. The prices has doubled, 10 times more of the price of dollar. Usually we could travel to the different countries, even in United Kingdom. But these days with the price of pounds come to 2013, it's very expensive.
More expensive, more pollution, more dangerous. Every more that you can think in really bad way.
What is the solution for you?
We cannot do anything inside. Just now I know that.
President Trump says he thinks and he hopes he can do a deal with Iran and some of the sanctions are lifted. Would that help?
I think that it is more than these things. The things that made us to come to the streets was not about nuclear.
Why did you go to the streets?
For me, it was just bad management, about price, about the bad quality of life. Not for me, not just for me, for everyone.
If they fix the economy, would that be enough?
For me, one of the things is economic subjects. For the other person, some political options. For different person have different objectives and different things and different problems.
When you were out on the streets last month, what was it like for you?
It was a mix of everything. Many persons were together, and just you could see that they are have problems, but not the same problems. And because of this, it was so dangerous.
And did you hear shooting? Was there?
Yes.
Did you see people killed?
Yes.
And tell me about that.
I just closed my eyes and ran away because I couldn't tolerate and I can do anything for him. Really scary.
Thank you. So let's move a little way from the crush of people around the fruit and vegetables into this warren of shops. Let's go inside this one. How is business these days?
It's not good that much. The prices, day and day, higher.
What is most affected? Which goods, if we look on the wall of all these goods, what is most affected by the inflation?
I think saffron.
Saffron, why? Yes. It's Iranian saffron.
Yes, Iranian saffron. It's up to double price.
Is it a problem of sanctions, the international sanctions?
I think so.
Are you hoping that the talks between the United States and Iran will succeed?
I don't want to negotiation with Iran and America.
Why?
Because we have in a bad situation, in economical situation, we are in bad.
What do you want to happen? What will help your life to be better?
I think to coming Reza Shah Pahlavi. Come here and save us.
You want the monarchy back?
Yes.
And why do you think that's better?
I think it's better.
Reza Pahlavi wants the United States to attack Iran. Do you support that?
Yes, absolutely.
What if Iranians would suffer?
We have raised for 47 years in Iran. And we have in a bad situation. As a young man, I work hard and hard every day, but I don't know. I don't hope this country is. So I think I go to another country for living.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for sharing your views. It's been so striking on this visit. How many people are ready to share their views, at least when they're reassured that it would just be their voices on the radio. And sometimes the views are so bravely expressed. But whatever the differences that we hear, everyone seems to agree that life gets ever harder and something's got to change.
Lisa sat there in Iran, working under the condition that none of her material is used, by the way, on the BBC's Persian service. That's a restriction that applies to all international media operations who are allowed into the country.
It is now 26 minutes past seven, and let's head to Edinburgh because Mike is there with the sports news. Morning, Mike.
Yes, morning again, Darshini. Welcome back to Edinburgh, where Scotland rugby fans are waking up this morning to prepare for what their head coach calls the biggest game of their season. They meet England at Murrayfield later in the second round of this year's Six Nations, having suffered a shock defeat last weekend away to Italy in their opening match of the competition. Now, I've got to say, it is -2 here currently in the city centre. There's even a bit of snow forecast later. Thankfully, at the moment, we are inside, about to have a bit of breakfast, actually, but continuing to build up to the big match later. Let me just bring you a flavour of the back pages here in Scotland. The Edinburgh Evening News, desperate Scotland playing to keep Six Nations alive, they say, against England. The Herald have a special Six Nations pullout. They say old enemies clashing capital with Townsend under fire and Scots out to prove a point. Townsend being the Scotland head coach, Gregor Townsend. What paper is this? The Scotsman on their back page and the Scottish Daily Mail, in fact, both carry quotes from the Scotland captain Sione Tuipulotu this morning. We're desperate, say the Mail. Scott Skipper insists victory over England is vital for his troubled team and the Scotsman as well. Tuipulotu calls for Scots unity. Well, I went down to Murrayfield myself yesterday to speak to the Scotland skipper, Sione Tuipulotu, and he started by reflecting on that disappointing defeat to Italy last weekend.
It was a very frustrating game, particularly after the first 20 minutes. It became almost just like a contestable off, you know, like we were going to try and win the aerial battle, and that's what the conditions demanded. I can't remember playing in conditions like that ever in my career, and it was a very frustrating day, and we prepared so well as a backline to get our hands on the ball and go challenge them, but ultimately didn't make enough of our opportunities in the first 20, and then after that, you know, the game's circumstances kind of changed it a bit. So I know the backline especially is very motivated, but confidence hasn't left us. I know the guys playing inside and outside me, and I don't know what we've achieved together. So, you know, just because we didn't get our hands on the ball last week doesn't mean I'm going to come to this fixture and bow my head or think that there's a better backline playing than us, because I really don't think that.
How much soul searching has there been in the camp this week after that defeat in Rome?
Yeah, it's gutting, you know. I'm not hiding from that. Even for me, I can't remember myself feeling like that after a loss, just because we'd done so much work individually and also as a team between the Autumn and the Six Nations, and then all of a sudden a game like that gets away from you and you can't finish it at the end. It's so frustrating. I can't explain to you, you know, like what an athlete goes through a couple of days after a game like that. But the other thing is that we also put into practice a lot of things that we worked on. We went down two scores early and we managed to win actually the wet weather battle 15-6, I'm pretty sure. So we won in those conditions, but ultimately we didn't do enough at the end of the game, and that's the part that hurts. But I suppose in our change room we have to make sure things could be a lot different if we did finish off that game in the change room. So yeah, there has been a bit of self-searching. We had to regather, and it probably took maybe a little bit longer than I'm used to. Usually back at club, or you know, even in another game, you kind of wake up the next morning and you kind of shake it off. But this one hurt a little bit more, and I didn't feel right till like Tuesday or even Wednesday morning, still hurting from that game. But I've turned the page now, and I'm really motivated to go out there and, like I said, give the fans a performance that not only we're proud of, but also, you know, the ones that haven't given up on us sitting in the crowd, proud of us, one that they're proud of.
Yeah, you talk about turning the page. Is it difficult to shift the focus from that most recent defeat, which is obviously fresh in the memory, to looking ahead to a game and a fixture which Scotland have got a brilliant recent history in, England just winning once here in a decade?
No, I think it's pretty easy because it's a Calcutta match, you know, and I think that's the beauty of sport, is that it hurts obviously losing the week before, but quite quickly you've got another opportunity, or we're lucky enough to have another opportunity to make amends, and it's just happens to be one of the big fixtures of the year in Scotland. So we're really motivated, and yeah, in a way I kind of feel lucky that it is a Calcutta match, because we won't lack any motivation, and neither will they, and it makes for a great game.
That is the Scotland captain, Sione Tuipulotu, speaking to me at Murrayfield yesterday. Should say that that match later here in Edinburgh, not the only Scotland against England clash in world sport today. The two sides meet later this morning in the group stages of cricket's T20 World Cup out in India. That game starting at 9:30. That match, Justin and Darshini, taking place in Kolkata. Our focus, though, the Calcutta Cup in the next hour. We'll be joined by not one, but two former Calcutta Cup winning Scotland internationals. Whoa. That's to come.
And I will happily answer to Justine if you're concentrating on running. Mike, thank you. Now, Broadcasting House coming up in the morning, tomorrow morning. Here's Paddy with what we can expect. Morning, Paddy.
Justine, how lovely to meet you. Newly poised. Well, we're going to meet our BH listener who is swapping life as an accountant for a career as a plumber. There are many younger people thinking ditch university and go blue. We'll see what's going on. We review the new Wuthering Heights film. It seems rather more Quivering Heights. It's got more bonkbuster in it than previous editions. Can you put the plot of Wuthering Heights in a sentence, we ask. A Conservative bemoans the chase to replace the Labour Prime Minister. Is it just possible that journalists got overexcited? And we meet the men-only walking group seeking friendship and celebrate good news for one of Britain's biggest old birds, Justine. Back to you.
Sounds unmissable. Well, 28 minutes to 8. Thanks, Paddy. A quick reminder of that weather. Crisp, bright day. Some wintry showers may linger for far northern and North Sea coasts. It is going to turn cloudier and breezier in the west in the evening. Guess what? Rain and hill snow.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Darshini David and Justin Webb. Here is a summary of the news from Lisa Costello.
The woman at the centre of the largest rape trial in French history, Gisèle Pelicot, has told the BBC she was crushed by the horror of her ordeal, but that she is a survivor. 51 men, including her husband of nearly 50 years, were convicted in 2024 of rape, attempted rape and sexual assault. Dominique Pelicot drugged his wife with insomnia medication for almost a decade in order to abuse her and to allow others to do the same. Speaking to BBC Newsnight, Gisèle Pelicot said she hoped to visit her ex-husband and get answers from him, which she said was part of rebuilding herself. Sir Keir Starmer will say that both Reform UK and the Green Party pose a risk to Britain's safety in a speech at a security conference in Munich today. The Prime Minister is expected to set out his foreign policy vision, calling on Europe to end overdependence on the United States and to cooperate more closely on rebuilding its defences. Sir Keir will criticise what he calls the easy answers of the extreme left and extreme right. President Trump says he's ordered the world's largest aircraft carrier to deploy to the Middle East, increasing pressure on Iran over its nuclear program. The USS Gerald R. Ford will become the second American carrier in the region. Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney has addressed a vigil for the eight victims of Tuesday's shooting in the town of Tumbler Ridge. He said that the whole country was in mourning. The chair of the Commons Public Accounts Committee, Sir Geoffrey Clifton Brown, has accused the outsourcing firm Capita of running a shambles in its handling of the civil service pension scheme. There's a backlog of 120,000 cases. Capita says it's drafted in extra staff to address the problems. Team GB has its first medal of the Winter Olympics. Matt Weston won gold in the men's skeleton, becoming the first British man to take Winter Olympic gold in more than 40 years.
Thank you for that. It is just coming up to 25 to 8. One of the few European leaders gathered in Munich for the security conference who has maintained a really good personal relationship with Donald Trump is President Alexander Stubb, the Finnish president who has played golf with Trump and has avoided falling out with him over Ukraine or indeed over Greenland or anything else. And President Stubb, I'm delighted to say, joins us on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What is the current state of your relationship with Donald Trump? Are you still talking?
Well, yeah, I think in diplomacy you always have two pillars. One is state to state, which is about interests, values, geography, history and culture. And the other one is the personal. And I think my job as the president of Finland is to try to have a good personal relationship with the roughly 200 presidents around the world.
Keir Starmer also has tried to have a good relationship with Donald Trump and has largely succeeded, as you have. On the other hand, Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, probably one of the presidential hopefuls for the Democrats in 2028, is there in Munich and has already said, hasn't he, to European leaders, you're making the wrong approach to Trump. Appeasing him, as Newsom puts it, doesn't get anywhere. Is it time, do you think, for a rethink?
Well, I think the job of the president of Finland or the prime minister of the United Kingdom is quite different from the governor of California, who's aspiring to become a presidential candidate.
Yes, although his advice was to you. It wasn't his own personal view of what he does. Yeah. It was you.
No, I think what we have to do is we have to be pragmatic with the relationship. And I think there's a lot of noise around it, and I fully understand. So we have to understand that the transatlantic partnership is changing and the ideology of the current administration is different to that of Europe. Some of the interests and the way in which they're driven are different. And also the use of power is different. So then we come down to the question, what do we do? I think we do two things. One is we cooperate with the United States where we can. So on defense and NATO security, minerals, and in the Finnish case with icebreakers. And then we cordially disagree on things such as the European Union, international institutions, or climate change. And while we do that, the second thing that we have to do is to take more responsibility of our own security. And of course, for Finn, that's a given because we have 1,340 kilometers of border with Russia.
And on that question of taking more responsibility, there is talk, isn't there, in Munich this year about the nuclear umbrella and how in the future it could be that Britain and indeed France, and Macron is making a speech about this soon, isn't he, might give nuclear guarantees to other European countries in the future that differ from those in the past. Do you think that is something that should be actively considered now?
Well, I think nuclear policy in general globally is changing in the sense that it used to be very binary. It was the Soviet Union, the US, later Russia and the US, the only two big players. But now we have a third player, which is China. It has 600 warheads going up to 1,500 by 2030. We have roughly 40 countries that have the capability to build nuclear weapons. So we need to start looking at deterrence and how we can basically tone this down. The second thing then is the nuclear umbrella. And here, I still trust the American nuclear umbrella. I'm pleased that the United Kingdom has nuclear weapons and France as well. But I'm sure there'll be a conversation about broader European nuclear arms. But I still think that the key deterrence for us is the US nuclear umbrella.
Right. That's interesting that you say that. You don't think then that there's been such a big change in terms of America's willingness to come to Europe's defence, possibly with nuclear weapons, potentially with nuclear weapons, if Europe were invaded more?
No, I mean, I always with the transatlantic partnership, and I'm very pro-European, pro-American, and therefore, by definition, pro-transatlanticist. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I would argue that Davos, the World Economic Forum meeting, was bad for the transatlantic partnership because of Greenland. And I think what we're seeing here in Munich today and yesterday is a pragmatic reset. So what I would call for with the US is less ideology, more policy, and we'll weather this through. I mean, the transatlantic partnership is never perfect. I mean, I don't need to tell the Brits about the Suez Canal crisis. I don't need to tell the French about leaving NATO. So we're in a similar type of moment, but we'll weather it through. If I look at the silver lining, I've never seen the UK closer to Europe than it is right now. As an honorary Brit, I'm really happy about that.
And on that subject, do you think Britain is going to be involved in this loan guarantee scheme that brings the entire European defence industries together and potentially bolsters them? At the moment, there's an argument, isn't there, about money, the money it would cost Britain to join that scheme. Are you confident that Britain will be part of it?
Well, I think they should be part of it. And this is my personal take. Why? Because right now, when we're seeing a slight rupture in the transatlantic partnership, and we're seeing the UK taking a very strong role, for instance, in Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine, the United Kingdom is close to Europe. And when we start working on our common defence, I think the UK needs to be involved, not only in NATO, but also on the industrial side. So again, if there's a silver lining to all of this, I think countries like the UK and Norway are now much closer to Europe than they have been since 2016.
Meanwhile, you mentioned Greenland and the fallout that there was. This is, of course, the first Munich Security Conference since Greenland and since the threats to that territory that were made by the Trump administration. Is that now settled, in your view?
Well, I hope so. I mean, the Danish Prime Minister and the Prime Minister of Greenland met Foreign Secretary Marco Rubio yesterday, and from what I hear, the conversations went well. Look, in Davos, we were between a rock and a hard place, and we had three scenarios, the good, bad, and the ugly. The good one was that we get an off-ramp and start focusing on Arctic security. A bad one is that we go for a trade war and increase tariffs. And an ugly one was the continued military threat coming from President Trump. We were able to get the off-ramp, so we sort of parked scenario two and three. And now there are two processes going on. One is between Denmark, Greenland and the United States. Hopefully we'll get results. And then the other one is to beef up Arctic security. And for me, let me be clear, the Arctic is much broader than just Greenland. The strongest Arctic forces that we have in Europe are in Finland, Sweden and Norway. So any way in which we can beef that up within the alliance, I'm happy.
Final thought about Ukraine itself. Zelensky, of course, is there in Munich, isn't he? You were telling him and telling the Ukrainian people very firmly recently that they can still win this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I met Zelensky twice yesterday, once in a slightly bigger group and then one-on-one. I think we need to change the narrative on the war. Look, Putin has lost this war strategically. He failed in the sense that he wanted to make Ukraine Russian. It became European. He wanted to prevent the enlargement of NATO. He got Finland and Sweden, and he wanted to keep European defense expenditure down, and we're hiking it to 5%. He's failing militarily. In December, 35,000 Russian soldiers died. In January, 30,000. That's 65,000 dead in 2 months. Compare that to Afghanistan, where they were for 10 years, 18,000 dead soldiers. They are trying to advance, but in the last 2 years, they have advanced 1 percentage point of Ukrainian territory. At this rate, they will not get the Donbas in the next 2 years. So this has been a military failure of Russia, and in that sense, a success for Ukraine. A final point, they have failed economically. Their growth rates are zero, their reserves are out, their inflation are in double digits, interest rates 16%. He won't be able to pay his Russian soldiers. So now we need to increase the pressure on Russia so that they end this war together with Ukraine, because Ukraine is on top.
Alexander Stubb, President of Finland, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
17 minutes to 8. Now, in this challenging era, how do you inspire young people not just to step away from those screens, but to aim higher in their ambitions? Well, the Horizon Youth Zone, which throws open its doors in Grimsby today, where over a third of children grow up in poverty, is aiming to do just that. This opening is being marked with a special poem, Ambition, written by Simon Armitage, which will be immortalised as a giant mural in the youth centre, written in the handwriting of the young people who helped to develop it. Let's take a listen.
They say the horizon doesn't exist, that it's nothing more than a fuzzy smear where land and sky pretend to kiss. But this town is all about edge, isn't it? That sickle of coast to the east, quick sunlight that sharpens on wet roofs, the bladed wind. When Grimm sailed in from beyond the brink, he carried tomorrow, a child, on his back. You kids are the kids of his kids of his kids. Your dreams are made of fiery stuff. A flame burns on your breath when you sleep. See now, when the dock tower fishes the dawn out of the oggin and lifts up its catch, the horizon opens its burning gates. Step forward, the future starts at your feet.
Simon Armitage there. Well, I'm pleased to say that Lord Jason Stockwood, UK Minister for Investment, member of the UK House of Lords and chair of the board for the Horizon Youth Zone, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Daphne.
Now, we should say this is a very personal issue, isn't it, for you, being a Grimsby boy?
Yeah, and I'm quite emotional hearing that poem read out, actually, because it's, I've been a fan of Simon's work since the early 90s. And I think having a world-class artist like Simon write this original work says something about, you know, how we see young people here, that they deserve a world-class building, you know, world-class youth provision, but also, you know, world-class art. So it's an emotional day for me, being from the town and being chair of the youth zone.
And you worked with Simon on this poem, didn't you? What do you hope to achieve by it?
Well, it was amazing, actually. So I had this idea that, because I loved his work so much, that I would just like to see young children feel like that they deserve something of this calibre. So Simon, I was fortunate to be connected to Simon, and you know, the accessibility and yet the insight and the wonder that Simon creates in his work is something that we want to inspire the young people of. So it's a poem deeply rooted in the past of the town. You know, the Lay of Havelock the Dane is a story from the Middle Ages, the 13th century. But it also speaks very specifically. The image that you heard there is about, you know, that the fisherman Grimm, the original name of Grimsby, found this boy called Havelock and identified him having divine powers because he saw a blue flame when he slept. And so there's something about that imagery of seeing the divine power and the brilliance in all our young people that this poem hopefully inspires.
And you can talk from first-hand experience, can't you, of the importance of youth work and how this plays into your hopes?
Yeah, look, I'm a council estate kid from the town. I went to youth clubs, and it was partly that having those trusted adults and having, you know, people that showed that they invested in me, that gave me the support and inspiration. That youth provision has gone away. This government, you know, is the first national youth strategy in 15 years, driven by young people. So we need that youth work to make sure people feel valued and that they can reach their full ambition.
Yeah, I mean, talking about the government, you are a minister, and, you know, I talk to businesses up and down the country, and they say government policy means they cannot afford to take on young people. What do we need to do in policy-wise to ensure that businesses can provide those kind of opportunities?
Look, I'm not seeing that in some ways. I mean, in this project, which I wanted to speak about, it's my personal capacity today. This is a really sign that our communities come together. Now, Britain is not, in fact, broken. That the partnership between the government, our local businesses, philanthropy and the public sector, and ultimately the community, can build these types of provisions that create both the conditions and the ability for young people to reach their full potential. So this is such a positive story today, which is about our communities coming together. But the government strategy of our youth youth policy is supporting that.
Well, talking about, you know, boosting spirits, you're also the co-owner of Grimsby Town. You play Wolves as a club tomorrow in the fourth round of the FA Cup. What are the hopes for another giant killing then? And how important is that when you're talking about boosting the spirits in the community and ambition?
Well, look, this was part of a longer-term strategy, having institutions in our town, an institution of the past, the football club, which people identify with. This is an institution for the future. But look, in terms of the game tomorrow, you know, on paper, you know, Wolves are a Premier League team, they should beat us, but it's a game played on grass ultimately, so everyone's got a chance when you're playing for 90 minutes, so I'm optimistic. This is going to be a great weekend for young people, and a great weekend for Grimsby Town in general, hopefully.
Well, we shall keep our fingers crossed for you, Lord Jason Stockwood. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And that brings us to 12 minutes to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker right here in the studio this morning is Martin Rowe, writer on culture and spirituality. Morning, Martin.
Morning. A king, a queen and a seraph, the highest of the angels, alive but miniature and grown in bell jars in the garden shed by an amateur alchemist. This is the setting for Small Prophets, a new BBC comedy in which eccentric hoarder and loner Michael Sleep is desperate to find out what's happened to the love of his life, who vanished without trace. He turns to alchemy and creating these small prophets. Homunculi, stay with me, is the technical name for these tiny supernatural creatures that he and co-worker Casey are secretly growing. The homunculi have the answer to every question, and whatever you ask them, they have to tell the truth. Maybe they can tell Michael if his ex still loves him. The series is written by Mackenzie Crook and right up there with his earlier classic, The Detectorists. It's charming, poignant, funny, and quite a bit bonkers. But then it's a fine line between what someone sees as bonkers and someone else as sincere everyday consolation. One of my relatives keeps the ashes of her late husband on the mantelpiece and takes his advice on what to watch on telly in the evening. The idea for Small Prophets came to Crook after reading about a medieval Swiss alchemist, Paracelsus, known for bringing chemistry to medicine, who speculated on generating miniature humans in vials. Crook describes the show, quite perfectly, as a sad comedy. A sadcom, as opposed to a sitcom. Its bittersweet beauty lies in the wounded souls at the heart of it, broken by loss but woken by imagination. A sad comedy might also be a way to build the Christian season of Lent, which begins this week. On Wednesday, Ash Wednesday, millions of people around the world will visit a church, where a cross will be drawn in ash on their foreheads. They will be told, in no uncertain terms, that they are going back to dust. A dark humour, Lent is nothing if not honest. A 40-day course correction in life, Lent is a chance to reflect on the call of being human, as every precious day rushes by. It's known in Eastern traditions of Christianity as the season of bright sadness, hinting at a flash of illumination in the penitential sorrow. Bright sadness? Sad comedy? This resonates with a wise reading of faith captured by the American novelist and minister Fred Buechner, who says we must understand life as tragedy, comedy and fairy tale. First, we admit the tragedy of our limited days. Then we notice the comedy of being loved and being able to love. And finally, we may see that we're all in a fairy tale in which impossible things happen to impossible people. And that's no small prophecy.
And that was Thought for the Day with Martin Rowe. It brings us to 10 to 8.
Now, despite the High Court ruling yesterday that the Home Office's decision to proscribe Palestine action was unlawful, the group remains banned pending those further legal arguments. But what does that mean for those on the ground, those who have to enforce the law and manage protests? The Metropolitan Police have said it won't arrest people who express support for Palestine action, saying these are unusual circumstances, but that it will be collecting evidence on what may still be criminal offences. Let's speak now to Sir Peter Fahey, who's a former Chief Constable for Manchester Police and the former National Police Leader for Prevent, and also was part of an independent commission looking at terrorism legislation this year. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, this is quite a detailed statement from the Metropolitan Police. I think the most telling bit for me is it says this is the most proportionate response it can take. It does put the police in a very tricky position.
Absolutely, it does. Yes, it doesn't mean that the original arrests were unlawful in any way, because clearly the ban was lawful at that time. In time, the Crown Prosecution Service will have to make decisions whether to proceed with the prosecutions. And even if they do, they could be subject to jury trial and more uncertainty. So absolutely, it puts the police in a very difficult situation. This was a difficult situation from the start. A big group of people openly said they were going to defy the law in a very public place in front of Parliament. So the police were left with no option but to act. But they've suffered a lot of verbal attacks about this. Sadly, some officers have been injured, and it's taken a hit to the confidence of policing. And of course, this is in the context of the conflict in Gaza, the huge tragedy there. There are people from all sorts of groups on different sides. But the fact is, it does boil down to the Muslim community and the Jewish community, with the police often caught in the middle, listening to the representations and strong views of both sides, and trying to, you know, adopt a fair and proportionate position. Even in the context of this statement from the Metropolitan Police, they'll be conscious that there are still other laws about protest, about hate crime, about support for other terrorist organisations that they'll be keeping very much in view.
Yes, which, you know, begs this question that, you know, they're having to tread a very careful line now. As you say, these are very sensitive issues indeed. Does this risk, this gulf that's opened up between what the courts have said and what politicians decided, does this risk undermining public trust when it comes to policing?
It does, but I think it's up to, you know, public trust in legislation. But the police, unfortunately, are used to this. You know, often there are particular situations, particular protest movements. Politicians understandably feel under pressure to act. They bring in various forms of legislation, often, you know, in a bit of a rush. They're subject to then interpretation either through judicial review or by jury trial. And that original legislation is undermined. We saw a huge amount of legislation come in to stop, for instance, the protests against HS2. And of course, HS2 has been stopped, but those statutes are still there. And the trouble, it makes it very complex for the policing of protests. We've got intersection of terrorism law, public order law, the law concerning the protests, public order, and hate crime, and the police on the front line having to make sense of this. So unfortunately, they are used to this, and it does really say that we do need legislators and politicians to pause and think carefully about legislation, but also how legislation is interpreted, because, of course, this situation comes from terrorism legislation with quite a wide definition of terrorism, a wide definition of how an organisation can be prescribed, and then a wide definition of what support for that prescribed organisation means. And that's, you know, led to the court case. But of course, there are still a lot of uncertainties about what the final decision will be.
Indeed, and we have to wait some days to find that out. But as you say, that legislation, you know, prescription came about 2000, very different time when we were talking about the funding of Al-Qaeda and the issues surrounding that. So how do you think that definition needs to be revised, narrowed perhaps, so that we do get legislation which translates into policy that is actually, you know, clearer, more effective and frankly, less controversial?
Well, the commission that I was on certainly said the definition need to be looked at again, particularly on this point about criminal damage, which is a really, you know, the nub of this particular case, and that the definition is too wide. But it's also about, as I say, the rules about when an organisation can be prescribed, which, again, we thought needed to be tightened. And also this situation about showing support for an organisation, which, right, as you said, originally was about things like funding and radicalising people, and has now been widened into show other forms of support, including just having a banner. And a lot of people feel that's far too wide. It's got us into this particular situation. And of course, it then conflicts with the right to protest. And the police, again, are very much aware of this. So really, all this needs to be looked at and tightened very much in a different international situation. And the fact that the threat, the nature of the threat of terrorism has radically changed.
It has. I mean, and the Home Secretary, of course, you know, the Home Office was in quite a tricky position at the time. And the Home Secretary, we should say, said that the court has acknowledged that Palestine Action has carried out acts of terrorism, celebrated those who have taken part in those acts and promoted the use of violence. Of course, the court felt it didn't meet that high bar that was needed for prescription. But we are in the position we are in now. And you alluded to this earlier on. Over 2,000 people have been arrested, over 700 charged. What do they do? Are you concerned they now will be looking to take action against the police?
One would hope that people would respect the fact that, you know, the organisation took it to law, took it to the court, and people should wait for the final outcome of that legal process, whether it is in the Court of Appeal or in the Supreme Court, and not put the police in a very difficult situation in the meantime. You know, if two people choose to, then absolutely the police will need to deal with that situation. But one would hope that people involved in this would now respect that the court has made a decision, but there are further steps to be taken, and wait for the final outcome and the final interpretation of this decision.
Sir Peter Fahey, thank you.
And that brings us to 3 minutes to eight. We have comedy tonight, perfect for the date.
This Valentine's Day, hear a double helping of comedy courtships. Stand-up meets dating in A Match Made Inshallah.
Yep, that's right, honey. Radio 4's going to help me find my man.
Fatia takes us with her on real dates.
I'm going to tell you all about it in my natural habitat.
I need to talk about this on stage.
Then we head to the 18th century.
Despite my very best efforts, I remain unwed.
Lady Clementine is looking for love.
I posted a Lonely Hearts ad in the County Gazette. My ad was immediately flagged for misinformation and hate speech. Boo!
Radio 4's Valentine's Day comedy specials. Tonight from 11.
And at 2 minutes to eight, it's time now for a look at the weather. Simon King is at the BBC Weather Centre this morning. Morning, Simon.
Morning, Dushini. Good morning, everybody. I can bring some sunshine finally today across the United Kingdom. We haven't seen that for a long time, but it is a cold and frosty start. And for some of us, some ice out there this morning as well. But for southwest England and across Wales, temperatures currently just below freezing, -2, -3 degrees in parts. And it's a lovely start to the day with some clear skies and there'll be lots of sunshine through this morning. We will see, though, some higher cloud moving its way in this afternoon. That will make the sunshine turn a bit hazy, but maximum temperatures getting up to about 5 to 7 degrees. For southeast England, eastern England and the Midlands, again, temperatures around freezing this morning. So we've got a touch of frost around, a little bit of cloud in the southeast, but that's going to clear. Looking at lots of blue skies and sunshine for most of the day. It's only really across parts of East Anglia where we might see just the cloud increasing, the possibility of one or two showers brushing the north Norfolk coastline and temperatures about 5 to 7 Celsius. Now, for northern England, a cold start with a widespread frost, the risk of some ice, especially over higher ground where we've got some lying snow. We will see there are lots of sunshine through today, just a bit of higher cloud moving into western areas, making the sunshine turn a bit milky, highs of 4 to 7 Celsius. And for Northern Ireland, yes, again, cold, frosty and potentially a bit icy. Lots of sunshine through this morning, but this afternoon we will see that cloud increasing from the west. And with that, some rain by this evening, turning to hill snow as well. A strengthening southwesterly wind, temperatures of 4 to 6 degrees. And across Scotland, lots of sunshine, cold and frosty this morning. Some haziness into the west later as the cloud increases with highs of 3 to 6 Celsius.
Simon, thank you for that. You are listening today on BBC Radio 4 with Dushini David and Justin Webb.
It is 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 14th of February. The headlines this morning. The woman at the centre of the largest rape trial in French history, Gisèle Pelicot, tells the BBC she was crushed by the horror, but explains how she carried herself through that experience with courage and dignity.
I think it's in my DNA. I was born like this because I experienced tragedies very young, through my grandmother, through my mother. And I always saw these women smiling despite everything they'd gone through. So I think it was passed on to me from a very young age, and I've built myself like that, always standing upright and dignified.
Sir Keir Starmer will use a speech in Munich to warn that Reform UK and the Green Party pose a risk to British security. And the new leader of 4 million Catholics in England and Wales will be installed as the Archbishop of Westminster today.
And also in this hour,
he has torn apart the skeleton scene all winter long. It would have been the injustice of all injustices if this gold medal hadn't come his way.
Following Britain's Matt Weston's emphatic win last night, we'll get reaction from the former Olympic champ, Lizzie Yarnold.
And good morning again from Mike Williams with your Saturday Sport live in Edinburgh on Calcutta Cup Day. A crestfallen Scotland sider preparing to face England at Murrayfield later, 7 days on from their shock defeat to Italy on the opening weekend. Coming up, we will preview the big match with two Calcutta Cup winning former Scotland internationals.
The BBC News read this morning by Lisa Costello.
The woman at the centre of the largest rape trial in French history, Gisèle Pelicot, has told the BBC she was crushed by the horror of her ordeal, but that she's a survivor. 51 men, including Madame Pelicot's husband, were convicted of rape, attempted rape and sexual assault at a trial in Avignon in 2024. Gisèle Pelicot has been speaking ahead of the publication of her memoir to BBC Newsnight's Victoria Derbyshire. Her report contains distressing details.
From 2011, for almost a decade, Gisèle Pelicot was repeatedly drugged and raped by her then-husband, Dominique Pelicot. He also brought dozens and dozens of other men he'd met on the internet into their home in order to rape her too, filming the abuse and storing the footage on his laptop. Madame Pellicot said being told what her husband had subjected her to had a devastating effect.
I told myself that it was inconceivable that this man who shared my life could have committed these horrors. It was a descent into hell. Our family was totally destroyed. We were crushed by the horror.
However, Gisèle Pellicot also said she is a survivor, that strength is in her DNA, and she urged rape survivors everywhere never to feel ashamed.
You can watch Gisèle Pellicot, the Newsnight interview, on BBC iPlayer now and tomorrow night at 10 o'clock on BBC Two. Sir Keir Starmer will say that Reform UK and the Green Party pose a risk to Britain's safety in a speech at a security conference in Munich today. The Prime Minister will accuse his rivals on the left and right of being soft on Russia and weak on NATO. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
This is a major speech from the Prime Minister, setting out his foreign policy vision and calling on Europe to end overdependence on the US and cooperate more on rebuilding its defences. But his mind seems drawn to the political battles at home. Sir Keir will use the international platform to attack the easy answers of what he calls the extreme left and the extreme right. The future they offer is one of division and then capitulation, he will say, and warn that under their watch, the lamps would go out across Europe once again. The attack was dismissed by a Reform spokesman who said Sir Keir refuses to find the money to increase defence spending, and by a Green Party source who said he was a caretaker Prime Minister running scared.
The conference in Munich is taking place against the backdrop of worsening ties between the US and Europe. The American Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, is due to address the gathering after telling journalists yesterday the world was in a new era of geopolitics. From Munich, our Europe editor, Katia Adler, reports.
The Munich Security Conference is seen as a sort of annual litmus test of transatlantic relations. Over the past year, the Trump administration has slapped tariffs on Europeans, tried to bolster politicians in Germany, Hungary and Poland, for example, that Washington believes are in tune with what it views as Trump values, and threatened the sovereignty of NATO ally Denmark over Greenland. So, the conference speech this morning in Munich by the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who represents the White House here, is awaited with bated breath. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte told me he was confident the US was more committed than ever to the continent. Now Europeans were upping their defence spending.
The US is completely committed to Europe, more than ever, I would argue, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, because they see the Europeans stepping up, Germany spending twice as much in 2029 than it did in 2021. 115 billion euros is a staggering amount. It is more than the French and the Brits combined. So they're really taking that leadership role.
But the US has also been clear Europe is no longer a top priority.
The President of Finland, Alexander Stubb, told us that EU-US relations were recovering after serious splits over Greenland.
What we're seeing here in Munich today and yesterday is a pragmatic reset. So what I would call for with the US is less ideology, more policy, and we'll weather this through. I mean, the transatlantic partnership is never perfect. I mean, I don't need to tell the Brits about the Suez Canal crisis. So we're in a similar type of moment, but we'll weather it through.
President Trump has said the world's largest aircraft carrier will be deployed to the Middle East as the White House maintains pressure on Iran to make a deal over its nuclear program. He said the USS Gerald R. Ford would travel to the region very soon and warned of traumatic consequences if Tehran failed to reach a deal. Our North America correspondent Simi Jolawasha reports.
President Trump spoke to journalists after attending a military event in North Carolina. Asked whether he wanted regime change in Iran, he said it seemed like the best thing that could happen. He declined to say who could replace Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. He noted there are people who could take over. Iran is yet to respond to Mr. Trump's latest remarks. This comes as the world's largest warship heads from the US to the Middle East, making it the second American carrier in the region. Despite the military surge, talks are set to continue, with US envoys expected to meet Iranian officials on Tuesday.
A partial shutdown of the US federal government has come into effect after funding for the Department of Homeland Security ran out. Thousands of workers, including airport security officers and disaster relief officials, will either be furloughed or have to work without pay. Democrats refused to approve the department's budget because of the killing of two US citizens in Minnesota by immigration enforcement agents. The chair of the Commons Public Accounts Committee has accused the outsourcing firm Capita of running a shambles in its handling of the civil service pension scheme. Sir Geoffrey Clifton-Brown was speaking to Radio 4's Moneybox after two senior executives were questioned by MPs on Thursday. Thousands of civil servants have been left without pension payments, and the scheme currently has a backlog of 120,000 cases. Capita says it's drafted in extra staff to tackle the delays. Sir Geoffrey said his main concern was the people affected.
This is truly a mess. But the trouble is that behind these shambles of Capita taking over this scheme, there are a lot of really pressing personal cases. People who are desperate to pay their mortgage, not getting a pension paid. People whose relatives have died, not able to get access to the lump sum payment.
A new leader of the Catholic Church of England and Wales will be confirmed at a service at Westminster Cathedral in London today. Richard Moth will be installed as the 12th Archbishop of Westminster. Here's our religion editor, Ali Makbul.
The installation mass will mark the formal beginning of the ministry of Richard Moth as Archbishop of Westminster and leader of the estimated 4 million Catholics in England and Wales. Rites of the ceremony date back many centuries, and during it there'll be a public reading of his appointment letter, Pope Leo having had the final say on his selection. The service will culminate in the passing of a pastoral staff to the new Archbishop from his predecessor, Cardinal Vincent Nichols, who's retired having been in the role since 2009. As the new Archbishop, Richard Moth has vowed to speak out on issues of social injustice. He's talked in the past about dignity and empathy for migrants who fled conflict and about his concerns about divisions in society over race and immigration.
Team GB has won its first medal of the Winter Olympics, with Matt Weston taking gold in the men's skeleton. It's the first gold medal for a British man at a Winter Games in more than 40 years. Weston smashed several records on his way to victory at the Cortina Sliding Centre in northern Italy. Joe Curry reports from Livigno.
Matt Weston was always going to be the man to beat, but if he felt under pressure, it didn't show. He cemented his status as the best skeleton racer in the world as he made history by winning gold in emphatic fashion in Cortina. Weston, who was already world champion, set a new track record on all four of his runs. The 28-year-old is Britain's first ever male skeleton champion and now also becomes the first British man to win winter gold since the figure skater Christopher Dean in 1984. Later today, Team GB's female skeleton racers will have their go at the podium. Tabby Stoker was fifth fastest after the first two runs.
Joe Curry reporting.
Thank you for that. 8:10 is the time. Gisèle Pelicot, the woman at the centre of the largest rape trial in French history, has told the BBC she was crushed by the horror of her ordeal, but that she's a survivor. For 10 years, she was drugged and raped by her own husband, who brought at least 50 men into their home to rape her. In 2024, 51 men, including Madame Pelicot's husband, were convicted of rape, of attempted rape and of sexual assault. But she made the remarkable decision to let the world know who she was. She waived her legal right to anonymity before the trial of her rapist began, and she made that powerful plea that shame must change sides. As the news of her bravery spread, so did crowds of women gathered outside the court to offer their support to her. Gisèle Pelicot has been talking to BBC Newsnight's Victoria Derbyshire about how she's rebuilding her life. And just a warning, you may find some of what she describes distressing, but as you'll hear, she also offers a message of hope.
Can I take you to the autumn of 2020, when your life as you knew it changed forever? Your husband was arrested for the crime of filming underneath the clothes of three women in a supermarket. He told you what he had been caught doing and that he'd had his phone and computer seized. How did you react to that?
J'avais vu qu'il avait changé. Donc, je lui ai dit, est-ce que tout allait bien?
I saw that he had changed, so I asked him if everything was all right. And this is when he admitted that he'd done something stupid, that he'd taken upskirt pictures of two or three women. Then he started crying and told me he didn't want to lose me. I think the fear of losing me has always obsessed him. He promised that he'd learned his lesson and that he would not do it again, so I told him that I would keep it a secret. I wouldn't tell my children, but there would be no next time because then I'd leave. And on the 2nd of November, I discovered the extent of what he'd done to me over 10 years.
And it was at the police station that you discovered what had happened. An officer requested that you, both of you, come to the station. He talked to you and your husband separately and asked you questions like what your husband's character was like, what was a typical evening, if you liked to entertain, if you were into swinging. He then informed you that your husband had been taken into custody for aggravated rape and drugging you. He said he was going to show you some photos that you wouldn't like. Can I ask, Madame Pellico, what you saw when you looked at those images?
Je vois deux ou trois photos, mais je ne me reconnais pas sur ces photos.
I see two or three photos, but I don't recognize myself in them. This woman is lying on the bed as if she were dead. There are men next to her. I don't understand who they are. I don't know them. I've never met them. And then something explodes inside me. I was in such a state. It was like a tsunami. It took me a while to realize what had happened. I think I only started to understand once I'd got home, when I called my friend. They'd asked me not to be alone. I told her, Dominique is in custody because he raped me and had me raped. That's when I used the word rape. It was after 5 hours of questioning that I put words to Monsieur Pellicot's crime.
It was the officer who had said to you, 53 men came to your home and raped you. That moment, it must have been devastating. It must have been as though you're plunged into a parallel universe, perhaps.
He gave me the figure of 53, but they later found that there were many more who hadn't been arrested. There are 20 or 30 men still out there, walking free. So I didn't understand what was going on. I told myself that it was inconceivable that this man, who shared my life, could have committed these horrors. I told myself that my life was in ruins, that I had nothing left, apart from my children. They came the next day. It was a descent into hell, for me, but also for them. Our family was totally destroyed. We were crushed by the horror.
On est pulvérisé dans l'horreur, en fait.
You were actually angry with yourself that you hadn't noticed anything in the 9 years, at least, that he was drugging you with his own anxiety and insomnia medication, poisoning your glass of wine or your food in the evening. Why were you angry with yourself?
Parce que je ne me suis rendu compte de rien.
Because I didn't realize anything. I saw nothing. I think it was right at the beginning when he started drugging me, in fact. I didn't remember what I'd done the day before, so I said to him, you're not drugging me by any chance. And when I saw him break down in tears, I immediately thought there might be something wrong because I have an excellent memory. I really remember a lot of things. And there, I couldn't remember at all what I'd done the day before.
You write, he had wanted to force an insubmissive woman into submission. In the end, you say you were punished for saying no to his fantasies. Is that an explanation for what he did?
Je le pense. Oui, parce que il aurait aimé.
I think so, because he would have liked me to participate in swinging sessions, and I always refused because I had a sense of modesty. Going to that kind of club was out of the question. So I think he found a way around it by subduing me. That's what he said. I subdued an unbreakable woman. Because in my marriage, I wasn't at all a submissive woman. I always worked, he always shared the housework. We were always quite a modern couple, even though we got married in the 1970s. I think he'd found his way around it, and he satisfied his fantasies by subduing me chemically.
You made the remarkable decision to let the world know who you are, to waive your legal right to anonymity, which meant the trial of all these men would be opened up to the public and the media, and everyone would know who you were. Why did you choose to do that?
When I decided against a closed hearing, I wanted the shame to shift to the other side. I'd carried that shame for more than 4 years. That self-inflicted pain, I felt, meant victims were being punished twice, and I thought that if I was able to overcome it, all victims could do it too. I'm sure of it. They must not lose confidence. They must dare to choose a public trial. It's very important. It's also a path to self-recovery. Shame must be carried by the accused, not the victims.
There has been an outpouring of support for you from people around the world. Let's talk more about those people, particularly women, who began to wait for you each day at the court and formed a guard of honour as you walked into the building and then applauded you as you left the building. How did that make you feel?
Their presence outside brought calm in the face of what was happening inside the courtroom. They gave me incredible strength, and I think my story echoed their suffering. They identified with my story. The women I met were often victims who'd never dared to file a complaint, and quite a few told me they would now have the strength to do so.
And you wrote that the crowd saved you.
Yes, you go through hell in a courtroom. You're really humiliated. Nothing has changed much, in fact. Victims are still made to feel like the guilty party. So yes, when I came out, the applause gave me enormous strength. And seeing my name plastered on the walls of Avignon, this name as a banner, my story as an example, it gave me a lot of strength. Alone, it would have been very difficult, I think.
What Dominique Pellicot did has had a devastating impact on your whole family. The police found two photos of your daughter Caroline on his computer, asleep in bed, taken by him. Caroline believes her father abused her. He said he hasn't. Can I ask what you believe?
What Caroline is going through is extremely painful, and I'm devastated by her suffering. There's the incestuous way he looks at his daughter, of course, which is deeply troubling. And there's also this doubt that condemns her to perpetual torment. She filed a complaint against her father. I hope she gets answers. For now, I support her. We've reconnected recently. She called me just before Christmas. But for my daughter, it's a descent into hell as well.
And it put immense strain on your relationship between you and your daughter. Can I ask how you are?
It's wrong to think that such a tragedy brings a family together. It took us a long time to rebuild ourselves. Everyone rebuilds as best they can. It took Caroline time because she's filled with hatred and anger, feelings I don't have. I have neither hatred nor anger. I felt betrayed and outraged by Monsieur Pellicot, but that's just how I am, that's how my DNA works. Caroline is different, and it's true that each of us needed time to find our own path. Today, we're trying to bring each other peace, and I hope we're on the right road to healing, all of us together.
Monsieur Pellicot was given the maximum jail sentence for what he did to you and for bringing men into your home and your daughter's home to rape you. 20 years in jail. Will you ever see him again?
I haven't had the opportunity to go and see him, and I hope to do so. That's also part of my way of rebuilding myself. I wasn't able to speak directly with Monsieur Pellicot during the whole trial. I always address the presiding judge. So I think I need to go and see him to get answers. I don't know if I'll get them, but face to face, I hope he'll be able to give me the answers I'm still seeking.
So you will go and see him in prison and ask him the questions that you want to ask?
Yes, I hope to do that.
And Madame Pellicot, if I may, I feel like you are one of the strongest women I have ever met. There is a life force in you. Where does that strength come from?
I think it's in my DNA. I was born like this because I experienced tragedies very young, through my grandmother, through my mother. And I always saw these women smiling despite everything they'd gone through. So I think it was passed on to me from a very young age, and I've built myself like that, always standing upright and dignified.
I know that you received a personal letter
from Her Majesty the Queen, Queen Camilla. And both she and you have given us permission to share the words with our audience. I'm going to read the words, if that's okay with you. Dear Madam Pellico, having followed the trial for the past 15 weeks, I very much wanted to write to express my heartfelt admiration for the courage, grace, and dignity with which you have faced the horrific crimes committed against you. You have inspired women across the globe, and in so doing, you have created a powerful legacy that will change the narrative around shame forever. Thank you for all that you have done. You are much in my thoughts and prayers, and I do hope you will now be able to rest and recover from this devastating ordeal. Camilla R. What did it mean to you to receive that letter?
It was an honour for me to receive this letter. I wasn't expecting it at all. And I was overwhelmed that this queen could send me this letter. So I was surprised because, although it's true my words touched the whole world, I wasn't expecting a letter from the Court of England. I felt moved and very honoured that she'd become aware of what had happened to me. I'm grateful to her.
Merci à elle.
You say you have found love again. Some people may be surprised by that.
Et j'ai toujours été tournée vers les autres, vers l'avenir.
I've always been focused on other people, on the future. I didn't think at all about falling in love or even wanting to. But life put a man in my path who has the same values, the same principles as me, and who's also been through many ordeals in his life. And we had the stroke of luck. We fell in love like teenagers when neither of us was expecting it. So you see, life always holds beautiful surprises. It's brought a lot of colour into our lives.
Gisèle Pellico, merci beaucoup.
Et moi, dis-moi merci.
And if you've been a victim of sexual abuse or violence, details of help and support in the UK available at bbc.co.uk/action line, or you can call for free any time to hear recorded information. The number is 0800 077 077, and you can watch the full interview on iPlayer now. It's also on BBC Two at 10 o'clock in the evening on Sunday. So on iPlayer, search for Gisèle Pellico, the Newsnight interview.
It is now 24 minutes past eight, which I think means it's now time for the sport with Mike. Mike, hi.
Yes, thank you, Darshini. We are having breakfast in Edinburgh this morning as we continue to build up to the Calcutta Cup later. Scotland host England at Murrayfield this afternoon, still licking their wounds from that opening day defeat to Italy in Rome 7 days ago. Can they respond today? There is a big game feeling in the city centre today, and I'm delighted to say that we can talk to two men who not only know what it is like to play in a Calcutta Cup, but to win one as well. Multiple Calcutta Cups, in fact. The former Scotland internationals Rory Lawson and Hugo Southwell are with me here at the breakfast table in Edinburgh. Gentlemen, many thanks for joining us. Question to both of you. As we say, there is an undeniable buzz in the city this morning and all throughout this week. What does this fixture mean to the Scotland players?
Everything. This is the game that they're defined on every single year. You know, I think 5.5 million Scottish people tune in. They want this. Around the world, people tune in because this is the most historic game in our game in international rugby. It's the oldest fixture in the game. It's the one that gets the juices flowing. It's the one that gets the heart rates high. So last week's happened. Scotland are disappointed, but there will be, I'm not sure there's a huge belief in the nation at the moment, but anyone who forgets what this means emotionally for Scottish people and Scottish players forgets how, you know, they're losing sight of really the importance of this game.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, I was in town last night, and it's not just the, you know, the emotions that this game brings for both England and Scotland fans and the players, but there was a group of French people over and they say they've come to this game. There was 300 people on a plane from Toulouse to Paris to come to this game purely because of what it brings and the emotions it brings out in this Six Nations. So it just shows you what this game means to everyone, and it's going to be a massive battle.
And the pressure on Scotland, Rory, is undeniable, because after that defeat in Rome last weekend, they lose again today, championship's over.
Yeah, absolutely. And they came into this championship with hopes of, you know, going for the title, going for a championship. Is this Scotland's year? Get knocked over in Rome,
The one thing that you know is that there's going to be a reaction. You know, the most dangerous beast is a wounded beast. And I think for Scotland, they're not as big as a beast as England are. But I expect a huge reaction. The pressure is on. This is a championship-defining game. Because win it, Scotland go to Cardiff in round three, still in the championship. Lose it, and they'll go down there, you know, licking their wounds and hoping to hang on to something.
England will certainly beware of the wounded animal in Scotland. What about the pressure, Hugo, on the Scotland head coach, Gregor Townsend? Been in the job 9 years. A lot of speculation, though, that his time in charge could be coming to an end. He's been strongly linked, hasn't he, with a job at Newcastle Red Bulls.
Yeah, huge pressure on him today. And you know, the selection is, I'd say, you know, a bit of stubbornness. He's picked the players on form last week against Italy. They haven't gone out there. Yes, it was a horrible day to be playing rugby, but they haven't produced the level that we know they can. He's gone with a similar team. Obviously, few and force changes in the fours. Backs remain the same. Didn't get much ball last week, but I expect a completely different performance today. But there is pressure on these guys because from a back three perspective last week, I thought they weren't, you know, at a level that they can be positionally. They needed to be a bit better. Tom Jordan, you know, got caught out on the first try slightly by coming up too hard on the outside channel. So there's a few things they needed to work on this week, and I expect them to do that and come out with a much better performance today.
Just on the team selection, Rory, no Duan van der Merwe again for Scotland, the wing missing out. A lot of Scotland fans I've been speaking to this week are annoyed at that selection. He's got great form against England in particular.
Yeah, Duan the destroyer in the Calcutta Cup, you know, seven tries in this fixture. And he you know, Scotland's record try scorer alongside Darcy Graham. Darcy's on the bench, Duan's not in the squad at all. So you've got, it's an interesting call. Gregor will have his reasons behind it. The stats will tell him something, and he will have seen things in training that suggest that Duan is not the right man. But it's definitely shocked a few people. And I think when you then add in Blair Kinghorn as a British and Irish line test starter, There's a lot of experience missing within that squad, and it's definitely grabbed some headlines around it. But Gregor Townsend's time is his 100th test as Scotland coach, and this could be his most important test match of his entire tenure.
Give the Scotland fans some hope, Hugo. This England side, they've won 12 matches on the spin, but what are the chinks in their armour that Scotland could exploit today?
I was saying last night that this England side is as good a side. I think they've got the selection right for the first time in a long time. They've picked the right players in the right positions. It's going to be a very difficult afternoon. I'd love to just be sitting here saying this Scotland side is going to go out there and get the result. It's going to be a very, very hard day for them. But they have to start the game well. If they go behind early, it's going to be a long way back. Because this England side, they know how to win at the moment.
Go along with that.
Yeah, I'd say so. You know, 13 is unlucky for some. So I think for Scots, they'll be hanging on that. Anybody who loses sight of the emotion that comes to Scots on this fixture lose sight of the importance of this and that Scotland in this game. Scotland's record at Murrayfield against England in recent times has been great. I was with Ben Youngs, Anthony Watson, Dan Cole last night. They've not won many times up at Murrayfield. There aren't a huge number of this squad who have won up at Murrayfield. And I think coming here, they'll know what they're coming to England. Scotland have got to start. They've got to get out of the blocks and build pressure because that is the way that they can get into this game.
Just one win for England at Murrayfield in the last decade. Briefly, finally, to both of you, as we say, you've both won this fixture. What will this city be like if Scotland, later on, can pull off a big upset and beat England?
Well, we've been fortunate, both of us, to be, I think 2006, 2008, we won. We drew in 2010 here at Murrayfield. We've experienced it, and I can tell you, it is some party along George Street. So I look forward to that later.
I've got one word, chaos.
Well, we shall see what unfolds. Will it be a famous win for Scotland later at Murrayfield, or will it be heartbreak on Valentine's Day for Gregor Townsend's side? You can follow the match live on BBC Sounds later. Kickoff is at 4:40. Should mention Ireland at home to Italy kicks things off at lunchtime. You can also hear that on BBC Sounds. And Wales host France tomorrow. That is a match on BBC TV. Not too late for you to get up here, Justin, to experience we hope. It's going to be a classic match one way or the other later at Murrayfield.
Mike, thank you. They ought to put it on the telly one day, rugby as well. Maybe they'll have that thought. Now, Saturday Live coming up later on Radio 4. Let us hear live from Adrian Charles. Morning, Adrian.
Good morning to you. Today on Saturday Live, we have a comedian, a nun, and a mortuary cosmetologist. So the comedian is Mark Steele, who's written another one of his brilliant books, this one about what he calls his adventures in Cancerland. Unbelievable story. The Leopard in My House, it's called. The leopard being the throat cancer which afflicted him, and he tells the story brilliantly, amusingly, wisely. It's going to be great to hear from him. Then we've got the remarkable sister Libby Osgood. She worked as an engineer for NASA before becoming a nun. Quite the career path, that. And our mortuary cosmetologist helps, using makeup, helps those who have died look their best, bringing great comfort to their families. Really interesting field of work. Also today, we'll be hearing about the pancake race just north of Milton Keynes, which has been going on for 550 years now, before Milton Keynes was even thought of, come to think of it. We'll also have the inheritance tracks of Matt Edmondson. That's Saturday Live from 9.
Thanks, Adrian. Certainly a packed agenda there. Well, what about the weather? Well, just a reminder, it's going to be crisp, bright, some wintry showers lingering perhaps in far northern and also the North Sea coast. And it could also get a cloudier and breezier in the west. But guess what? Some rain and hill snow in the evening, perhaps.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4, Dashini, Dave and Justin Webb. It is 28 minutes to 9. Lisa Costello has a summary of the news.
The woman at the centre of the largest rape trial in French history, Gisèle Pelicot, has told the BBC she hopes to visit her ex-husband who assaulted her and get answers from him. 51 men, including Dominique Pelicot, were convicted in 2024 of rape, attempted rape and sexual assault. Speaking to BBC Newsnight, Gisèle Pelicot said confronting her former partner was part of rebuilding herself. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has in the past few minutes told world leaders gathered in Munich that the US and Europe belong together. He said Washington was not seeking to end the transatlantic partnership but to revitalise it. In his speech later, Sir Keir Starmer will warn that Reform UK and the Green Party pose a risk to British security. President Trump says he's ordered the world's largest aircraft carrier to deploy to the Middle East, increasing pressure on Iran over its nuclear program. The USS Gerald R. Ford will become the second American carrier in the region. A new leader of the Catholic Church in England and Wales will be confirmed at a service at Westminster Cathedral today. Richard Moth will succeed Cardinal Vincent Nichols as the 12th Archbishop of Westminster.
Lisa, thank you for that. Just coming up to 25 to 9. The Munich Security Conference used to be a bit of a talking shop. The world's leaders gathered to keep us all safe. But we are no longer safe. And not only are we facing the threat from Russia, we're also living in a world in which the United States takes a very different view of its responsibilities. Indeed, has threatened to take over European territory. In those circumstances, does NATO still work? Does there have to be a new nuclear umbrella provided for Europe that doesn't include the US? Defence spending, of course, rising in Europe, but armies still relatively small. What is realistic when it comes to the defence of Europe by the Europeans? All of these things are being mulled over in Munich this year. Katja Adler, our Europe editor, is there. Katja, good morning. Set the scene.
Good morning, Justin. You're absolutely right. This is a Europe that feels so squeezed, you know, from the east with an expansionist Russia and an economically aggressive China. And then in the west, this former best friend, the United States, which under Donald Trump has become a lot less reliable. I mean, at the security conference at the moment, we've just come to the end of the speech that everybody has been waiting for. On stage, we had Marco Rubio, the US State Secretary. He's representing the Trump White House at the conference. And this conference, you're right, it has in the past at times been dismissed as a sort of talking shop, but traditionally it's also seen as a kind of temperature gauge of US-European relations. And if we have a look back at the last 12 months since the last conference, you've had the Trump White House slapping tariffs on Western allies, threatening the national sovereignty of NATO ally Denmark, of course, over Greenland. And last year, J.D. Vance, the US Vice Secretary, took to the stage and admonished Europe. It was a sharp intake of breath and shock. This year different. Marco Rubio adopted a far more inclusive tone of partnership towards European allies. He said that Europe and the United States belong together. But a number of the themes were similar. Criticisms about mass migration, the loss of sovereignty in Western societies. He said that the US absolutely wanted to work together with Europe on establishing a new global order, he said, a new century of Western civilization. But he said the US was prepared to go it alone if necessary. It didn't want allies that cling to the status quo. So a very strong message there. And I think, Justin, critics will point to the kind of values the Trump administration wants to defend, because as Marco Rubio leaves Munich, he will head to Hungary to support Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who's seen as the European leader closest to Vladimir Putin, with a strong anti-migration message as well. Security, of course, came up, even though Marco Rubio said the relationship between the US and Europe was about a lot more than security and defence. But on that front, of course, it's been very shaky indeed. I spoke to NATO Secretary General last night, Mark Rutte, and he said the worries about a break in transatlantic relations when it comes to security are overblown, because European allies are now spending so much on defence and have shifted their mindset.
But the shift in mindset is that you now see the Europeans taking more the lead when it comes to NATO and Europe. The Europeans really stepping up when it comes to defending Europe, and therefore the US being more anchored in NATO. Because finally we are dealing with what they wanted us to deal with, the Europeans, and that was spending more and taking more of the leadership role.
There was definitely a shift in mindset last month, wasn't there, in Greenland? The United States, NATO's biggest, most powerful ally, turned on fellow ally Denmark, threatened its sovereignty over Greenland, and then turned on other allies, including the UK, and said, if you get in my way over Greenland, I will slap you with economic sanctions. That was huge.
But what I am looking at is the positive outcome. And a positive outcome is that we came together as an alliance, deciding, hey, there is a point, a case in point here. We have to defend the High North collectively. We have to make sure that when it comes to Greenland, Russians and the Chinese do not get access. The US is completely committed to Europe, more than ever, I would argue, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, because they see the Europeans stepping up, Germany spending twice as much in 2029 than it did in 2021, €150 billion. So they're really taking that leadership role. This is noticed by the Americans. This is helpful.
France has taken from the whole Greenland episode that you have to stand up to Donald Trump. You have to be tough. You know, the EU threatened economic sanctions against the United States. And France is saying Europe has to be stronger. You say that too, but France says on its own two feet. Whereas you've been criticised by some in Europe for being too cosy with the United States. Some would say obsequious in your manner towards the US president.
We all agree here that for NATO to be strong, you need a strong European pillar. Nobody wants to break the bond with the United States. There's nobody who really wants that.
Well, their capabilities missing in Europe, aren't they? I mean, just realistically speaking, Europe relies on the United States still very much.
Yeah, but why would you break that bond? Nobody is really pleading for that. Even if the Europeans, which will be the case over time, will get more of these capabilities done on the European side, then still you want to maintain that relationship. Because for the United States to stay stable and strong and secure, they need NATO, because they need a strong and secure Europe, they need a strong and secure Arctic, they need a strong and secure Atlantic for its own safety and security. But they're irritant, they're pebble in the shoe, the US spending so much more on defense than the Europeans were doing. And that has been dealt with.
If we look at Ukraine, America is already withdrawn. There is no more direct aid from the US to Ukraine anymore. Will the US keep its capabilities for the rest of Europe?
Specific to Ukraine, there is a massive flow of US equipment into Ukraine.
But that's because Europe is buying it.
I know. But it is still a massive flow of US equipment, which only the US can deliver. Brits Kolbe yesterday in the defense ministers meeting was saying, hey, listen, yes, we have to pivot more towards Asia, the inner Pacific. The US is the biggest nation on Earth, the biggest, mightiest military, 25% of world economy, but they cannot do everything. So, yes, they expect the Europeans to take more care of the defense here, but he also made clear, we will stay involved, both conventional and nuclear. We are totally committed to Article 5, and hey, yes, we are seeing, there is such a difference between NATO now and NATO only a year ago, and the 2% reached, this commitment to 5%, it is really amazing.
That was Mark Rutte talking to Katja Adler. I've been talking to the Defence Minister, Luke Pollard, about what the British take is on all of this. And we began with a scheme to allow Britain to be part of the European defence spending umbrella. It's called SAFE. It's the Loan Guarantee Scheme. President Stubb of Finland telling us earlier that the UK should be part of it. Is the British government confident it's going to happen?
Well, we see there's a huge advantage in having more UK industrial cooperation with our European friends on defence. It's the reason why we've welcomed the door being opened to UK businesses in the United Kingdom participating in the loans from the European Union to keep Ukraine in the fight. Now, we've always said that we feel there's a good opportunity for the UK to participate in SAFE, but we wouldn't join at any cost, and it had to be in the best interests of the United Kingdom taxpayer and our industry. We weren't able to secure that deal in the past, but we see real advantages of bringing the UK and Europe closer together. And that's precisely what the Prime Minister is setting out in Munich in his speech, because we feel that the era of the Brexit days, where Britain's language and behaviour around Europe is definitely something of the past, and it needs to be in the past because of the threat we are facing. We can see that. And because of that threat, because we are stepping up on defence, and because Europe's security relies on Britain, just as Britain's security relies on Europe, we need to do more to work together.
Are you confident a deal will be done?
Well, we're seeing increased cooperation on a bilateral basis already. I think the Prime Minister's intervention today and his speech that says, look, we need to bring ourselves closer together. We need to work more closely between the UK and the European Union and between the UK and European NATO partners together. Now, that, I think, provides a huge industrial opportunity, because UK companies represent about a quarter of the European industrial base. So we know there's more opportunities here. And as we look to reduce our over-reliance on the United States and build our interdependence, so more cooperation and collaboration with our European friends, there's clearly an opportunity to do so in a more structured manner. And that's the kind of things the Prime Minister is setting out in his speech.
Another set of discussions going on, it seems, in the margins at Munich are about seizing the Russian shadow fleet, this huge group of tankers, more than 1,000 of them, that transport Russian oil around the world. And reports this morning on Bloomberg that John Healey, the Defence Secretary, is talking to his counterparts about upping the European game when it comes to those seizures. Is that something that the British government thinks should happen, that more Russian vessels should be being seized around the world?
I mean, certainly it's been the government's long-held position that we need to do more to clamp down on Russia's shadow fleet. That's why we've been increasing the sanctions. But since some of the recent activities of our partners that we've helped participate in, especially with our friends in the US and in France, there's opportunities to do more. Now, we're exploring what those are at the moment. I don't think we're yet in a position to be able to say more about that, because I don't want to give Putin any advance notice of what we're looking at. But clearly, being able to throttle the supply of oil into Putin's war machine that he gains such considerable international amounts of revenue from, well, that keeps Ukraine in the fight and reduces the ability of Russia to rearm, because we know they're rearming, not just in building a stronger military to attack our friends in Ukraine, but they're reinforcing and rearming their capabilities right across their military, including those that are poised and set off against NATO forces.
Final thought about our relationship with the US, Europe's relationship with the US. We were hearing from Alex Stubb, the Finnish president, earlier on, that there's been a reset and he thinks the relationship can go back to something useful now on both sides. Is that the view of the British government? Does there need to be any alteration in the way that Europe deals with the United States?
Well, the US remains one of our indispensable friends. The UK has the closest defence, security and intelligence relationship with the United States. But we need to reduce our over-reliance on them. And that's a message that this president in the US, and frankly previous presidents, have been saying to Europe for quite some time, that European nations were not taking on board. We need a stronger NATO in Europe, and to do that and to keep the United States having that strong military presence in Europe, which is in all our best interests, the United States as well as European NATO members, we need to spend more on defence, and indeed we are, extra $5 billion extra in the defence budget for the UK this year, rising to 2.5% in April 2017, 3% in the next parliament.
Yeah, but not 5% until 2035, which feels a long way off to the Americans and indeed to many people in Britain who are worried about the immediate Russian threat.
I mean, the 5% target is one that has been agreed by the United States and agreed by all European NATO members. What we now need to do is spend that money wisely. And as the Prime Minister will set out, there's massive duplication across Europe in terms of our industrial base, in terms of our military capabilities, but there's also considerable gaps. And the opportunity now exists for the UK to work more closely with the EU, more closely with our European NATO friends, to procure together. We're seeing successes from that. The 10 billion-pound frigate order from Norway to buy at least 5 Type 26 frigates that will be built in Scotland. The 8 billion pound order from Turkey, a key NATO ally, for the new Typhoon fighter jets. There's opportunities to create good, decent jobs at home and enhance our security. But to do that, we need to recognise that Europe needs to do more. The UK needs to do more closely with our European friends, and we need to continue our close alliance the United States. It's not one or the other, but it's more focus on Europe.
Luke Pollard, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
17 minutes to nine now. Well, the drought is over. A week into the Winter Olympics, Team GB has its first medal. The skeleton racer Matt Weston has become the first British man to win winter gold since Christopher Dean triumphed back alongside Jane Torvill back in 1984, that long ago. His victory was an emotional moment too for the first Brit to win two winter gold medals. She's Lizzie Yarnold, the skeleton champion turned commentator. I asked her for her reaction.
Yeah, it was hugely emotional. It's such a big moment in his life. Over the four runs, it's all about being consistent, being calm, which he did magnificently. But when he came through the finish line for that fourth and final time, you could see his body almost, he was almost stuck to the sled and the helmet was moving as tears were rolling down his face. And as soon as he took the crash helmet off, it was like the roar of the lion.
And it's not easy, is it, going into an event like that, being the favourite and pulling it off in such style with that margin in the end of just under 1 second.
I remember being the world number one going to Sochi, my first Winter Olympics, and he was even more the favourite than I was. And you're right, there's pressure on his shoulders. But I spoke to him last week and he said there's more pressure that he felt inside from himself, his perfectionism and desire to perform well, than there was from other people. You know, and they work with psychologists, with all their coaching staff, and Martin Stuka is a superb coach of his. So they have wonderful support that sits around them.
Last night's moment was even sweeter for the fact we've had to wait so long for that gold medal. Were you concerned about the lack of medals up till then?
I think in sport, we know that anything can happen. There are a few fourth places and the seventh place from Gibson and Fear. You have to celebrate these phenomenal performances. This moment in the athlete's life is everything. So we knew in skeleton that Matt was going to race well. The team texted yesterday to say that they were ready. You know, that's what you want people to be prepared. He just delivered the gold medal race when it counted.
It's been a real week, hasn't it, of high and low moments. I know you've expressed your disappointment with the IOC banning the skeleton athlete Vladislav Hereskovic over the images on his helmet of children and athletes who've been killed by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It's really tricky, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you've got this idea that the Winter Olympics should be somewhere where we can leave the world behind and get together and celebrate. And on the other, we are facing this real turmoil in geopolitics. So where do you draw the line?
You know, I think the IOC, you know, it's their role to work out where that line is drawn. But from the athlete perspective, I really felt for Vladislav. It wasn't only that he was trying to have an act of memorial with his helmet, but it was almost that they removed his accreditation, which was later reinstated. So he was a real medal contender. He's a phenomenal athlete. And the actual competition, how it played out with the four runs of the skeleton racing, it was a really exciting, fierce competition. So I'm really glad that the sport also was able to shine through.
And we've got some time ahead now. What are your hopes now for the days ahead?
So we have the women's race, runs 3 and 4 today. We have three British athletes Tabby, Freya and Amelia in the top nine. They're all first-time Olympians, so we'll just have to see how it goes today. I know that they're here to do their very best. They've had a phenomenal season so far, so I'm incredibly excited to watch them compete.
Plenty to keep us grip there today. Lizzie Arnold, we really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
10 to 9 is the time now. Time for our Saturday panel in which we look back on the week's news dominated by Keir Starmer's troubles, of course, but there was economic news as well that you might argue matters more than the fate of any one Prime Minister, although the two things, of course, are very much linked. Gillian Tett is on the line, Provost of King's College Cambridge, Financial Times columnist as well. And here in the studio, Stephanie Flanders, formerly of this parish, now Head of Economics and Politics at Bloomberg News. Morning to you both.
Morning.
Gillian Tett, first
of all. Good morning.
Bring those two subjects together, as it were, the Starmer's fate and the economics. Because one of the things that people have been suggesting is that, of course, if he is to go and be replaced, he will almost certainly be replaced by someone further to the left of the party. And that might have economic implications. Where do you think we are with the link, as it were, between who is Prime Minister and our economy?
Well, I think the most immediate impact if someone was forced out and someone from the left came in would actually be financial market implications, because there's a sense of real unease in the international bond markets and real fear that if the UK doesn't get its fiscal situation under control and above all else unleash growth, then the debt situation of the UK will create growing jitters in the bond markets. But if I have to sum up what's happening in the UK right now, I'd say the UK is basically in a holding pattern. It's in a holding pattern politically because, unfortunately, Keir Starmer has been very weakened, but is still there and is likely to remain weak, certainly with the by-elections coming up in a couple of months. And we're in a holding pattern economically because it's not disastrous, but it's not great either.
Likely to remain weak, Stephanie, but also likely to remain there, it would seem.
Yes, I think the chances, if you were looking back at, you know, how the Prime Minister has come out of this week, we've been confirmed, and certainly anyone in the markets looking will be confirmed, that this is a weak and potentially pliant Prime Minister. But I think one would also have to conclude that the immediate prospects of him being ousted, I mean, it's a famous last words for me to say this, but I think they are also weaker because everyone in the party, including the leading contenders, have kind of had to focus very clearly on quite how horrific it would be in the short term to go through that process, and have also realised they don't have very good answers to sort of basic questions like who would be your chancellor, what would actually be your new policy. So, I mean, Gillian's obviously right that what people, the investors, will be looking at is whether there are prospects for more focus on economic growth, on more sort of, if you like, market friendly, certainly more fiscally responsible policies coming down the track. I think that's perfectly possible, but it does involve a refocus either by this Prime Minister or by one of these leadership contenders.
Steph, we've spent a lot of time on today, the last week, talking about this boys' club aspect of all of this. And we've had women MPs and senior ones coming on and saying one of the things that's got to happen is that has got to change inside Number 10. Would that make much of a difference?
I think, I mean, the Labour Party has got a bit of form on this. I think the sort of default setting for Labour governments, actually slightly more than Conservative ones, although we've obviously seen it with them as well, is this slightly kind of blokey, quite closed environment, which, you know, which women in the past have got into, but it definitely, that is the kind of default setting. I actually think in this case, if you look back at the failings, I mean, so much of it is now focused on the Prime Minister himself. I mean, everybody else have been around him has been changed repeatedly, including senior civil servants, which I think is really corrosive for the kind of advice that future ministers will be getting. But you don't have kind of hands-on involvement from the Prime Minister. I can't remember how many times, just listening to this programme, you're talking to someone who's reasonably important to a particular issue or a backbencher or someone who runs a committee, and you say, well, have you spoken to the Prime Minister? And the answer is, well, no, I've chatted to him once at a party. I mean, you keep getting evidence of that he's just not involved in the key things that need to happen, including when it's about his own leadership.
And what's interesting, Gillian, is that, you know, one woman who has been quite prominent in all of this and has been a constant has been that first female Chancellor, Rachel Reeves. And talking to her this week, I mean, She pushed back when I said to her, well, Wes Streeting texted that you don't have an economic growth plan. She said, yes, we've grown the economy. Actually, you know, per capita, we went backwards for some of last year. The spotlight's been taken off policy delivery. You know, is there a plan there to your mind?
Well, I very much hope there is a plan. I do think that Rachel Reeves has been disappointing, primarily because I think the first budget was very ill-judged because of the complexity of the tax rises she imposed. But I would like to turn it a bit and say that if you want to look for a positive, inspiring example of where Britain could and should be going right now, not necessarily in policy terms, but at least in political terms, look to Japan, because Japan has just had a landslide win for Takaichi, the leader of Japan. She's emerged as a politician who, yes, is female, but has managed to both be of the dominant party political establishment, but also come across as anti-establishment in the way that she behaves. And most importantly, she's been ruthlessly realistic about Japan's problems, but also reminded the Japanese of why they need to be proud of what they do have, and has created a real sense of excitement that actually Japan can pick itself up after years of stagnation, get going, and actually be innovative. And Britain desperately needs a leader like that right now who can really unleash excitement and a sense of pride and, dare I say it, animal spirits, to quote John Maynard Keynes. And that's what's missing. And so that's much more important than gender right now. It's somebody who people can really rally around and feel a sense of pride and dynamism in Britain today.
Is it more important than politics? So, I mean, because I don't think most people listening will say Keir Starmer is not that leader, including people who like him a lot. But if we were to have that leader, are you saying that even if it took us slightly to the left and upset the bond markets, at least temporarily, that might be overridden by the good things that would come from it?
Well, I personally think lurching too far to the left right now would be very dangerous for the bond markets. But if somebody can unleash a sense of confidence and growth and animal spirits, that is what is desperately needed above all else. And little things like the fact that Takaichi, that of Japan, was seen drumming with her South Korean counterpart a few weeks ago in a totally novel way that got everyone excited and going, yes, here's someone fresh and dynamic. That is what is very unexpected in Japan, and that is what the UK needs right now.
Steph?
No, I would just say, I mean, I think maybe this will be a surprise to people. I think there are animal spirits and there is actually a bit of excitement out there. It's just nowhere near Westminster and completely not evident in Downing Street. If you look at the numbers, and there were some pretty sort of downbeat GDP figures this week, but that we actually think that that is a short sort of blip. We're not going into some sort of gangbusters growth, but there are real signs of optimism we've had. And some of the things even that the Prime Minister, the government has done, excuse me, some of the things the government has done has actually increased private investment along with things that were done by the previous government. We've had, I think, one of the fastest rises in private investment in the last couple of years that we've had in ages. We've got public investment not falling the way it had been. And at the same time, there's signs that AI is being actually implemented by companies. So I think, you know, again, we're not looking at sort of 3 or 4% growth, but we think growth will be a bit faster this year. And there is a lot of, for companies, a town terribly gloomy if you ask them about Keir Starmer. If you ask them about their own orders and their own things that they're doing, they actually suddenly sound quite upbeat.
But Steph, I mean, you have to look at both the economics and the politics of this, right? And we are in this holding pattern, as Gillian says. And how much of that is to do with the fact that perhaps some of the main challengers aren't quite ready to step up for their own personal reasons, but also because they don't have that confidence of the markets? How much of a say does the market have? Or are we just hanging out for their next by-election?
I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that we've